Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
I've been in Hong Kong now, let me think here, like 10 months? Yeah, 10 months. And I think I'm finally experiencing the true nature of this place. And what I mean by that is rain. Lots and lots of rain. I mean, this morning it was so humid. I couldn't even tell if it was raining or not, actually. It was just, the humidity was up so high. I could take a butter knife and sweep it through the air, and I'm sure it would come out with a couple drops of water on it. It was that humid. And then it for sure started raining after that. I mean, it was pouring. And that lasted many hours, and it drizzled for many more hours. And it's not just today. I'm recording this at the end of May, but for the last month or so, let's say in the last 30 days, I think it's rained probably about 45 days. It's completely insane. It's just become a regular daily thing. Not that it's like that all year. I've got the Lonely Planet here for Hong Kong in my left hand, and I'm opening it up to the Need to Know section, and you do need to know this. They've got a temperature and rainfall calculator, a calendar here. Looks like October, November, December, January, February, and March, those 6 months, there's almost no rain at all. And that's completely true. I remember there being very little for 6 months. And the temperature was quite pleasant for all six of those months. So if you're from the northern latitudes and want to get away from winter, I mean, January, February, those are great months to come to Hong Kong, or December too. But now we're in May and the temperature's up. It's not unbearably hot today, but that's just because it's been raining so much. April, you get some rain, but then May, it just spikes up. Let's see, it's about 8 inches of rain average in May. And June and August, 12 inches average rainfall in each of those months on a normal year. Ooh, I mean, that sounds like a lot to me. So Katie and I are going to be away for July, so at least we won't experience the worst of it, or we'll minimize the worst of it. But I got a picture of what's to come here for the next few months, and it's more rain. Not that I'm complaining that much, because honestly, it feels good sometimes to be outside when it's raining, when it's really hot. I mean, there's nothing worse than a cold rain, right? So it's not that, at least. It's never really unpleasant. It's just, in this day and age, we're all carrying phones nowadays and electronic devices. I've got my nice camera, and I'm constantly protecting it, trying to keep it dry, trying to keep everything in mind dry. So it can grate on you after a while. It can wear you down if you let it. But I'm trying to stay positive here, folks. Things are going to improve pretty soon, I think. And we do still have a day or two here and there where it's just beautiful, perfect weather all day. So do definitely come out to Hong Kong. Just try to avoid those summer months, because honestly, it's not even really worth it. And that's what we're going through now. Anyway, let's get into this show, because it is a long one. My guests today are Sim and Nathan. Sim is short for Simón, which means yes in Spanish, although that's not why she's called Sim. And Nathan is short for Nathaniel. Sim comes from Lithuania originally, although she's lived in England for her adult life anyway. And Nathan is British through and through. He's from southern, I think he's from around London. And they've been living in Liverpool for a number of years. All right, so they are couch surfers, and so I met them through couch surfing. And Katie has actually been joking around that maybe I should change the name of this podcast to the Couch Surfing Podcast. But honestly, it's really just that it's a travel-based podcast, and the people I meet who are really into travel, quite a few of them are couch surfers. It's a common thing. And some of the most interesting people I meet are couch surfers too. These guys are really interesting. They are, well, actually, as I record this, they're both in the air right now because they just finished their long trip. They traveled around the world for over a year. I think it ended up being 15 or 16 months in total. And we were the last stop. Hong Kong was the last stop, but we were the last stop, this couch surfing experience out here in Saigon. These guys were awesome. Katie and I had so much fun hanging out with them, and we went hiking. We cooked meals together. We really felt like we made some good friends in these guys. It was a fantastic experience. And when we recorded this podcast, we sat down and we just went off on a variety of topics. They talk a lot about their trip during the podcast, and the reason why they came to Hong Kong is a big subject of the discussion. I'm not going to get into it here, but they came here to do a workaway, which is, well, they'll talk about it, but it's a way to travel without spending money, which is really cool that this kind of opportunity exists. It's not just workaway. There's a few other ways to do this. But people ask me all the time, or say to me all the time, well, I wish I could travel more, but I just don't have the money. Well, there's ways to do it without spending much. You can really extend your trip as they have. They are traveling on a really low budget. I mean, not like Miljana. Miljana from last week's podcast, she travels with nothing. She doesn't have any money. These guys have some money, but they don't spend very much. And one way they've been able to extend their trip is by staying somewhere, working a few hours a day in exchange for food, in exchange for lodging, and then they've got the rest of their day to go around and explore, do what they want. And this is a way to travel. And I think a lot of people who have never gone on a long trip before are going to be really interested in this one. Also, I know it's a long podcast, but if you listen to the very end, they give some great advice about how to travel the world and just what to expect when you're going to do it. I guess that's all I really want to say in the introduction. Other than I had a lot of fun hanging out with these guys and talking to them, and I hope you enjoy this discussion. It's just a small piece of the 5 or 6 days that we spent together. Nevertheless, I think it is an interesting one. So let's get into my conversation right now with Sim and Nathan. First of all, tell me about Workaway, because I've never used this.
Okay.
What's Workaway?
You want to go?
Okay.
You used Workaway, but you introduced me to Workaway, so I think it's only fair that you...
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first went out traveling like 3-4 years ago, I wanted to do some volunteering, but, you know, a lot of the opportunities on the websites are, you know, kind of you turn up and you pay a lot of money, which I didn't have at the time. And then somebody mentioned Workaway, which is basically kind of like an exchange between the locals and the travelers, and is something that is kind of beneficial for both sides, I guess. But, of course, like, the intention is there to help others, right? But they often... you know, attract people by saying, like, while helping us, you can learn this, that, and the other.
Okay.
So it's for hosts is free. For the sort of
Workawayers, I think they're called.
Yeah, well, you're a workaway. I suppose you're a host is free.
Workawayites.
Yeah.
And but for people who want to do it, you have to like sign up to a membership, you know, blah blah blah. There's like reviews and things like that.
How much was it for us? It was like £30 for
you? It's like 40 or something,
So they make the workers pay. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's right. And the hosts, well, it depends really. Oh. If it's a non-governmental organization, if it's non-profit, then it's free. But if it's a business, then I think they also have to pay for it.
Yeah. Oh, okay, both sides pay.
If it's a business, you pay.
Yeah.
To be on, but if you're like an NGO or non-profit, then you don't pay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the business would then use, can then use, like if you were to work in a hostel or something, they can use your labor to make money.
Sure.
Technically, so it's only fair that they pay, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I was just surprised that the workers pay at all.
Yeah.
To perform work.
I don't know why. I think it's a bizarre situation.
Like same with like how couch surfing has gone and stuff.
So yeah, but normally.
You do save money. At the end, you realize that you've been in this place in the city for 2 weeks without having to pay rent or stay there or have to pay for food or anything. You think like that £40 for a whole year is kind of worth it.
Yeah,
that's how I justify it to myself anyway. The fact that you now have to pay for stuff like this,
I think it adds up. I mean, yeah. I guess when you are working at a job, you tend to just think of money as money. And I don't know, somehow at some point in my life, money transitioned into time.
Yeah.
And if I spend $30 on something, then I think, oh, I could travel for a day for that.
Yeah.
It just turns into that.
But then I've also started thinking that in terms of India as well.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Then that gets dangerous.
It gets so dangerous.
Yeah. You become such a cheap ass.
In a way,
it's like coming to Hong Kong, it's like, I'm not buying a bottle of water.
I'm happy we did India at the end, right?
Oh, my God. I mean, I've adjusted to the prices here because they're so high in Hong Kong. But right, just one meal in Hong Kong is like days of travel in India.
Yeah, so.
It's really takes a lot out of you.
Yeah, we have to constantly remind ourselves, of course things are going to be very different from India,
Yeah, of course.
Let's not expect anything too much. But but anyway, yeah. So the kind of conditions vary as well, like from the hosts. So if they want to offer you 3 meals a day or 2 meals a day, and they ask you how many hours you will have to work, sometimes it's like more than an hour, a day. So giving you a rough idea that there's not that much to do. And you probably won't get much in return. But then, again, it depends, Sometimes it's just families looking for people to look after their children and do some grocery shopping and stuff,
It varies completely. Yeah, some offer different. Payment as well.
Oh, they'll
pay. Some that offer payment, in all technicality.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
We haven't used one of those yet. No. We haven't been part of one of those yet. Although the woman who hosted us in Taiwan, she did give us money for food.
All right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No food, but money for
No food, lunch. But money for food. That wasn't a particularly large amount of money.
It seems okay as long as they're upfront about what they're giving you and what they're not.
Because there's a settling in period where you have to work out what you're getting, how much work you have to put in, and everything. It's not like woofing. Do you know woofing?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done it, but I've heard.
That's the same. They use that in Japan. Again, you have to pay for that as well. But that is to be on woofing, you have to be very, you actually have to write down what you're doing, how many hours that person works, what you would give them for that, and it's a lot more of a rigid actual system, because we used it in Japan, in Hokkaido, in North Japan, and we would be like halfway through a job and they're stopping that. You stop work now. And it's like, yeah, but I can just no more work. Now it's time for food.
Yeah.
Well, that's good then.
Yeah,
I don't know whether that was just a Japanese thing, but they'd spent time traveling, so they were, I wouldn't say Western, but less Japanese than Japanese people tend to be.
Okay.
And he was saying that woofing means that, like, for them to be on woofing, they can't take the piss.
Mm. Okay.
They have to be like, look after us for the work that we put in, whereas Workway's a little bit more. Mm. You get some cowboys on there where you work all day and they give you...
You're just a slave then at that point.
You really don't get much at the end of it.
Although I had a roommate who did woofing quite a bit in South America.
Yeah.
And she said it was hit and miss. Some of them were really good. They teach you... Because the whole point is to learn how to farm, right? Like it's not just...
Cultural exchange and stuff.
Right, it's not just the work. It's like you want to take this and apply it somewhere else and you can grow your own garden or whatever.
Yeah.
She said some of them were really like that. They really got it. And then some of them... or a couple times anyway, she went and they viewed her as a slave.
Yeah.
And they just want, you go out and work all day and I'm just going to give you like nothing. Right. And there was no exchange in that case.
Yeah. I think it's a good deal for the hosts. A very good deal for the hosts across the board, really. Especially if you're on farmland.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're in Japan where people don't really want to do farming anymore. Everybody's running away to the cities and getting into, high paid jobs.
They prop up their the farmers, they prop up through that, through woofing. It's like a major part of how they get their workforce.
Right, and I guess there's certain jobs on farms that have been more automated. I mean, farming's gotten so much more efficient, but then probably some that you just can't. Or it's just like really difficult to make a robot to, like, pick oranges or whatever.
Yeah. There was, like, a mixture of the two with us there. There was a planting the potatoes was half automated, wasn't it?
Yeah,
half.
It was like a giant tractor.
Yeah, it was a bizarre, it was a really bizarre contraption, which made it felt like you were on psychedelics when you got off, didn't
yeah.
it?
Because I would have dreams about being on this, you know, machine.
This tractor.
Where the potatoes are spinning, basically. Well, yeah, they're like spinning and there's holes and you just have to quickly like put them in holes and then it shoots them out into the holes underneath, right, as the tractor's moving forward.
But it's like a giant, they've got this super giant funnel of potatoes above you and you're sitting directly behind the tractor on the trailer, so you're moving along with the tractor.
Okay.
The bottom of the tractor cuts the divot and then puts cuts the divot directly underneath you and then puts soil over it just as you pass.
Okay.
So you have like a small window of where a potato falls into the hole before it comes back over again.
So it's really, really old.
Very old,
but yeah, and you have to just sort of do that all day long for 3 days in a row, and you close your eyes and you still have dreams of potatoes going around inside.
I know what you're saying.
So it comes down from the funnel, lands on like almost like a Wheel of Fortune type giant wheel.
Did you win a vacation?
yeah.
Like I just won disorientation. And yeah, so there's two. And you sit side by side, and they land, and you have to make sure it's not one potato, it's half of a potato. And then you have to make sure one potato is in every single one of these, maybe like 50 slots.
Huh.
And it's rusty, and it's old, and it's just potato, put in, and then there's a hole there, and it gets to the point where you use your peripheries to be like potato, and it's just
well, what if you just decided not to do the work and just pretend that you're doing the work? Wouldn't they just not know for 6 months or something?
No, we were micromanaged to some degree.
Oh, there's a guy with a whip behind you.
Yeah. Carrot in front and a whip behind.
Yeah.
No, actually it was their son, their 8-year-old boy, who would sit in the middle.
Had the whip?
Yeah. And you'd have to like fight with him a little bit sometimes. He gets in the middle, because the one who sits in the middle is the one who's looking out for the two people.
Oh, yeah, they do maybe 25% of each other person's job.
So they
fill in. If you miss your potato, they'll fill in your potato for you.
Yeah.
But you've already done 49 of the 50 potato slots.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're just there just in case there's an issue.
They've got a potato in each hand.
They have a handful of potato in there.
Ready to go.
Yeah,
kind of saving. Because otherwise, I guess 6 or a few months down the line, you realize that the potatoes were planted like really badly. So then you're like, who was here? And trying to investigate.
Go through your woofing ledger.
You're right, go through the books, look it up, and give you a strike.
Yeah.
But did you guys see the potato people, planters in Nepal?
No.
Oh, it was. I guess we were just there at different times of the year because we both did the Annapurna circuit.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
And we saw up toward the glaciers, below Menang, but not much below Menang. Those last few villages, they're right before the snow line. Really, they were. I think they were digging up potatoes. We were there about in like May of last year, so I think they were harvesting them, but no powered machinery at all. It was just a plow with an ox and then guys, people walking behind and bending down and picking them up.
We saw many water buffalo and people were buffalo and them.
Or yaks, I should say, not ox.
Yeah, some yaks, definitely.
Yeah, we saw farm work, like very antiquated farm work like that, but didn't get close enough to see.
Oh, yeah. Right, rough life there.
They're made of just something else, Nepalese, aren't they? They just like run past you, and you've been like on this path for hours. You're sweating, you've got your stuff, and they just come past in a pair of flip flops.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah, they're just used to
nothing.
Or like, do you remember like the solar panels, right? Yeah. They'd be like giant solar panels on their back, and they just like, move out the way quickly and then let them go.
Yeah, they're like ants.
Yeah.
Well, and not too long ago, the road only went just up to Besi Sahar or a little bit further, and so it's down at the road ends at like 900 meters above sea level.
Yeah.
Now these guys, to get anything past that, it was all manpower. And so this hotel owner, or what do they call them, tea house owner, mm-hmm. a few towns up that we stayed in, he said, yeah, like 5 years ago, we had to pay people to carry 100 kilos on their backs for like 3 days to get here. Yeah, he said they each carried 100 kilograms, and they walked really slowly and just set it down all the time, but it took them 3 days.
To get all the way out.
Did he say how much it was? Like to
pay? How much they made? I don't know. Probably $10 a day or less.
It'll be just the opportunity to do it.
But that's how much you pay the porters nowadays, isn't it? Like, something it's about $10 or $15 a day.
And they don't carry it on their back so much, do they? They have that strap across their
forehead. Oh, I know. Oh, that's right. Right.
They pull on it with that strap on their forehead, and it's like...
I mean, we didn't use any porters, but we saw a lot of people doing this. Yeah. You could hand them a $300 backpack that was brand new, made for hiking, and instead of wearing the shoulder straps, they hook up their own thing, and they just carry it on their head, on their forehead.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I guess it's just what they're used to.
Yeah, and you see them all come past, and like with like a varying degree of expertise, where the old guys carrying more and the younger guys start carrying less and less, and I think they build up the strength over the lifetime. It's the older guys, which are stick thin,
so
just veiny, and just made of cabled steel or something, and they're just carrying like four times what you're carrying on their head.
Yeah, I remember. Like it's nothing. Yeah, seeing a documentary actually on YouTube about like the longer expeditions to like Everest and stuff, and like how Sherpas would have to go the day before them and check everything and set everything up, like the whole camp and like all the oxygen tanks and everything, and they're carrying like crazy amount of weight on their backs, you know, and so many Sherpas die. Right. Like every year.
Well, they're the ones setting the lines too.
Yeah.
They're the ones that reach the summits before everyone else. Yeah.
Right. They climb all the way up and fix the ropes. Yeah, and they're taking all that risk. And then the Western climbers just jumar all the way up.
Yeah. Right?
So they're if they fall, I mean, in theory anyway, if they fall, it catches and they don't fall to their death.
Yeah. They're not the pioneers putting the real work in, are they?
Right. Yeah, I've got no interest in that anymore. Not that I ever really did, but just I've seen the photos of the...
Of like Everest Base Camp and stuff.
Just the line. Like, people died just because they were waiting in line.
Yeah, exactly.
You get up above 8,000 meters, the clock is ticking. You can't live very long above 8,000 meters, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
You have to just check your oxygen. You go through like the entire oxygen reserves, and all you've just done is moved like 400 meters forward in a line, in a small line.
It's just one of those things, you know, just to say I've been on Everest, you know, like
it's
like doing for the sake of it or something, you know, like it's just such a trendy thing now or something.
Yeah, I think that when it comes, I have like a small amount of anxiety when it comes to traveling now. It seems like the golden era is coming to an end of traveling, where, you know, wherever you go now is going to be, there's just many tales of, 10 years ago this was amazing.
Yeah.
But now there's...
Right, it is, but it isn't. I mean, I think truly the golden era was like a century ago.
Yeah.
Because then there were, because then people hadn't been to the poles yet.
Yeah, that's true.
And there were really remote places that were just no people. And now it's that era's done. The end of the Victorian era, kind of.
And they got into the jungle.
Yeah, I love the era of like Shackleton. And really, I'm a big fan of Shackleton. Yeah. What's his name? Percy Fawcett went into the jungle and.
Just kept moving through.
And got killed and eaten or whatever.
Yeah.
But so today that's done. But it's so amazing. Maybe the biggest tip I could give anyone, or one of the biggest tips for anyone who's new at travel, is just walk three blocks. Mm. Wherever you are, if you think it's crowded with tourists, just walk like three blocks.
Yeah, just.
And there won't be any tourists.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's just... It's really pure again. You're outside of that zone. And that pretty much goes for everywhere I've been. And I've even been to some places, which you might read about if you keep reading my books. Mm-hmm. Like a friend of mine and I bought a dugout canoe from some native people in Bolivia. And we just started canoeing for a couple weeks down this river without a map or anything. And it was the river that borders Bolivia and Brazil. So you have Bolivia on one side, Brazil on the other.
Oh, that's incredible.
And just camping. And we did a couple of these trips. One, we were camping on beaches on just sandbars. And then one, we would just have to find villages because there weren't other real spots. And, but the people there had really clearly never seen foreigners or like Westerners
before.
You just
turn up in this canoe on the river.
Yeah, right. And it's still totally possible to do that stuff because while there is a ton more tourism than there used to be, it's all concentrated in small areas.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
And I guess world travel and adventure really has to be internal. I mean, there are still a few records that haven't been broken and things that haven't been done, that list is dwindling quickly. Mm. So it has to be about just pushing yourself and your own boundaries and finding your own adventure wherever you go.
Yeah.
Well, same as like Poon Hill, you know, you guys did Poon Hill on the way back, right?
Yeah, we did.
Because we kind of skipped Poon Hill because we got there quite early on in the evening. And Poon Hill is, you know, right? It's just like full of big tour groups and stuff like that, right? So it's like a really big spot. And for people who just want to go away for like 4 or 5 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you walk up, because we got to Gorapani like quite early, so we thought if we keep walking for about an hour like up the hill, we'll reach the next place, and we'll wake up in the morning and we'll watch it from there.
Oh yeah, sorry, I've only just come into this.
And
no,
we went
no,
there.
Now you know where she's sitting.
Like, oh, yeah, that was great. That was so good.
Yeah, and Poon Hill. I think how many people were there when you?
Oh, hundreds.
Yeah,
right? Crazy. Yeah, yeah. I know. And so, and we went, and I mean, I still thought, you know, there'll probably be some people, but definitely not as many as Poon Hill. Uh-huh. And and then we went up and not a single person, and we saw probably an even better view than you would have seen from Poon Hill.
Yeah,
you know?
that was
a tiny
stunning
little viewpoint, and it was just insane, you know. And
I think I know what you're talking about, actually, because we did that Annapurna short trek and took that. It's on a trail, right?
It's like a white. It's like
You have to keep going.
Towns or villages or hamlets or
the next one up
that you want to go past.
Okay.
And a guy that we met just as we went over the pass in Annapurna said about it, and we wrote it down.
No, he didn't say about that. He said about the one on the other side. So actually, we were supposed to wake up 2 hours before, right? At like 4 a.m.
Yeah.
To walk up this like Moldai and go and view it there.
Mm.
Probably would have been an amazing view there as well. But this lady who owned the guest house, the tea house, she was like, oh, there's like tigers there. Not tigers, sorry.
Tigers.
Tigers or something, you know? She's like, there's like wild tigers there, so just be careful, you know? But she said it so casually, like it's like no biggie. And then we're like, oh shit, you know? We're going to go up this like treacherous
It wasn't just tigers, it was other things as well, like bears. Or like, she said tigers, but she also said something else that was dangerous. I can't remember what it was, but I remember
Nathan
thinking like...
Nathan has an issue with bears.
I don't like bears.
So. Oh, really?
I'm scared of bears.
Well, bears are pretty scary.
Yeah, I just think of that moment where if a bear charged you, you're like... Yeah, you surrender yourself then.
You just can't do it. Well, it depends on what kind of bear.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
If it's a grizzly, I mean, you just got to roll up in a ball and try to protect yourself.
I just think it'd be a horrible way to go. I don't know. It's more like an irrational thing that...
Yeah.
But whenever we like wild camp and there's like... We wild camped in Hokkaido and there's bears there.
Okay.
So like we're in the middle of nowhere and like I'm not sleeping.
He didn't even rest for a second. And I had a great sleep. But he had one of those whistles attached to his bag as well.
Yeah.
I like bought it really cheap somewhere. And he was prepared and he was just... I think if you didn't know that they were around, you would have been okay. But somebody
totally
who dropped us off at the location, it was just like a crater... type of lake, wasn't
it? Was
it?
Like a volcanic crater. It's giant lake we had to ourselves, and we were wild camping on the edge.
And somebody's like, yeah, there's bears there in the area. And then everything changed for Nathan, I guess.
Yeah, there was. It was like a bear sanctuary.
Right.
And we're wild camping with food.
Oh, right.
And I'm just thinking, like, I don't like the idea of somewhere. I like wild camping. It's beautiful. I like being in the nature. I like all of that. But I don't like sleeping in the tent at night. Like that's something I just have to deal with, because I always think whoever's outside the tent, if they're malicious, they want to do you harm, they know exactly what you are in that tent and where you're sleeping.
And then you're horizontal.
And you're horizontal and you don't know what's going on outside.
Right. So your mindfulness tricks on you.
Exactly. And if you want to see, you have to zip a small zip at the bottom and then poke your head out first.
Yeah.
Like it's like a guillotine.
Yeah.
Like you're as vulnerable as can be. If someone wants to do you some harm.
Yeah. You have to assume that.
You have to,
Yeah, right.
So,
God, well now you're making me not want to camp.
Sorry.
But I have that problem too, where when you're in a tent, you can hear everything too.
Exactly.
Yeah, so all the sounds get amplified.
I get it.
But it's got
a lot
to do with the... Blair Witch
Project. Yeah, you ever seen the Blair
Witch? No, I didn't see that one.
Don't watch it.
Okay.
Made me watch it.
Scariest
he would
film
mention
I've ever
it
seen.
All
really?
The time. Huh. And he made me watch it one night, and I was like, I wish I didn't see that, because I guess it's
pretty creepy. Do you want me to tell you a bit about it?
isn't it one of those first-person ones where they've got the cameras all shaking?
Yeah, they get lost in the woods and things start happening to them. But there's, like, bits where they're camping in the middle of the night and they hear, like, children crying or babies crying outside their tent in the middle of the night. And I'm like, imagine
if that happened to you.
Like, in the middle of the night, I would just lose it. You would just lose it.
It's pretty scary.
It's really. And it's such a... Plus, when you're camping, it's something different, too. And we're afraid of the unknown, I think. When you don't camp very often, and suddenly you do, just all the scenarios run through your brain.
And that's... Exactly. And, you know, just, I guess, because you are so much smaller, because you cannot stand your full height, right?
Mm-hmm.
And have you seen that video of that man confronting a wild elephant?
No.
So there's a video that I've watched not that long ago, and it's so... I mean, I don't know whether the guy actually worked in a safari or something, you know, but there's a wild elephant, right, approaching him and running so fast towards him. And what he does is just stands, you know, like proper still, and he looks the elephant directly in the eye, and this elephant is just shooting right towards him. And I'm not even kidding, maybe like this... close to him, and he just stops because this man is not running away. He's, you know, like, it's authority, it's like strength and power, and he's confronting this elephant, and it stops, and his ears just kind of go forward, you know, like just kind of wave, and he's there, he's just still, and this man is staring at this elephant, and this elephant is staring at a man, and nothing is happening, and there's just this moment where you're just like, oh my god, is this actually happening, you know? And then the elephant starts sort of retreating slowly a little bit, and then he starts like trying to intimidate the man again. So he like takes a couple of steps, you know, forward again, sort of almost like as if he were to attack him. And then he's, you know, he stands his ground and nothing happens. And then eventually this elephant just walks away, and it's like, and I think that's the thing, right? If you feel like you're tall and you're standing,
you'd have to like suppress fear or turn into another emotion, because the animals can sense that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you're small in a tent, right?
I'm going to be scared right now.
Yeah.
It's like what you do with bullies, too. Or like people, you see guys do, I mean, we're totally just animals, you know, we're just primates. Yeah. But you see guys in the street do this. Like one guy pretends he's going to punch someone, and, oh, you flinched, and the other guy's got to stand there. And
so you're weak.
I mean, I saw a video similar to that, but with a gorilla, too, with a silverback gorilla, where this guy was observing them, and then the gorilla charged. And gorillas are huge.
Yeah.
There's so much, they could just rip you from limb to limb. Like,
they get bigger as they get closer, too.
And the guy just had to stand there. And if he ran, then he'd be just fucked.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like a plaything then, isn't it?
He's so got to stand his ground.
It's just one of those things, isn't it? I mean,
right.
If you run, you're dead anyway. And, I mean, it might not work, the whole strong stance, you know, in front of a gorilla, but that's your only option, really, isn't it? Because...
They've got tiny balls as well, haven't they?
So you can't balls. Sex at dawn. Yeah. They don't need big balls because they have a harem.
Yeah, they don't need it. They've got everything they need.
Right. Oh, you can't kick them in the balls.
Can't kick them in the balls. No, it doesn't matter.
Oh, they'll be like, give me more.
But there was, back to the camping thing.
Yeah.
There was also another that I told you about, where there was a discussion on Reddit of the weirdest or creepiest thing that people had done when hiking, trekking, or camping.
Okay.
Oh shit! Yeah.
There was a woman that like got the most upvotes, so everyone was talking about it at the most. But there was a woman who back in the early 90s, I think it was. She did. I keep forgetting what it's called. It's when it goes down. It's like it goes down west, like California. It's one big trail.
Oh, the PCT, you mean? The Pacific Crest Trail.
That's it. Yeah, the one that's in Wild. Some woman solo trekking down there, and she camps and goes along the trail, camps again, and she keeps waking up around about the same time each night, but just like fitful sleeping, and gets this like odd feeling. And because back in the 90s, she has one of those windable disposable cameras with her.
Oh, I thought you were going to say phone. Like, you had to wind up your phone back then.
Like a big battery pack.
Get out the tin can and the string.
Send up. Yeah.
Okay, so she had a wind-up.
So she has a wind-up camera. And,
camera.
Yeah, and she gets back and she gets she has this like strange feeling, but it, you know, puts it in the back of her mind, and thinks maybe it's like raccoons or something. Yeah, so she gets back and she gets her camera developed, and there's pictures of her sleeping, like in the tent at night time. So someone's been following her, waiting until she falls asleep. They come into her tent, take a picture of her sleeping.
Wow.
And then leave.
And then leave the camera.
And then, and leave the camera. Like, it's her camera. They take pictures of the camera.
And she wouldn't know.
So she wouldn't know. So, like, they've been...
film is developed,
like,
yeah.
That is the creep... Because that's so, malicious. And they haven't taken pictures of themselves. They've just taken a picture of her sleeping.
Wow.
Yeah. Flash goes off. She, kind of half awake, put it down, zip it up.
That's so weird,
Oh, that's
right?
So creepy.
Yeah.
So stuff like that goes through my head in the middle of the night. And
And you could be like, anything could have happened to me and no one would have ever known.
Yeah, like what goes on in someone's head that does that to another human being?
Unless they thought it was hilarious. I don't know, maybe they thought, that's what I did to this woman or something.
Yeah,
Still, I mean, it's still...
In order for it to be a good joke, at least you got to reveal yourself.
Yeah, right? Because otherwise I got it's just left like that and you'll just never know.
I mean, I came back, I was in, I think I was in London. This is back when I had a film camera too. And some girls I was with, we were at a bar or whatever, and some girls said, "Hey, I want to take a picture of that sign. Give me your camera." And I gave them the camera, and took the camera back for like 10 minutes later, and we just went on our separate ways. And then I developed the film and looked through the photos, and there was a picture of a guy's ass. Like, so, somehow they had gone in the bathroom or gone on the corner or something with the camera, and gotten someone to pull down their pants and moon the thing. And, well, that was pretty funny.
Yeah,
you could do that back then, because you wouldn't know that what the picture was a few weeks later.
Yeah, when I was talking about the story before, people said, like, at least it wasn't. It's bad, but if you had a smartphone, and then you'd be like, "Oh, that picture's look at the picture of the cat. Oh, it's a picture of me sleeping."
Right.
But at that point, you're already out. Like, wouldn't you just, unsheath whatever knife you had with you and just stay awake until you went back to civilization? Because if you'd known that someone had done that during one night, like, there was some sort of comfort in knowing that she didn't know.
Right. That at least it was done.
Because imagine how much panic you'd. Thinking there's someone out here with me.
God,
I'm far away from anything.
Your heart rate, your stomach would drop, your heart rate would go, and you'd just be like super.
I mean, I will say some of the best nights of sleep and some of the worst nights of sleep I've ever had have been camping. Because sometimes I'm sleeping next to a river and it's just trickling and it's just perfect. Yeah. And the birds come in the morning and wake me up. And then you always go to bed so early when you camp, too.
Yeah,
so it just gets dark and you go to bed. And
something really nice, like waking up and just being like, getting like a cup of coffee on straight away. And like,
watch the sunrise. Yeah. And it's great. But then sometimes something will wake me up and I'm just, those things start going through my head. And I just can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, or if you need to go to the toilet, you need to wander around or outside. Like.
I remember my cousin, we were camping out in South Dakota. This is, again, a while ago. And I guess he was like 17 or something, or 16. And he said South Dakota has a lot of buffalo, right? So, or bison. So he got up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet. And then as he was coming back to the tent, he was like, I don't remember that buffalo statue being there when we set up the tent. And then he just went to bed. And then he really came up got up in the morning. He's like, oh, wait, that was no statue.
Buffalo.
Yeah.
We had... it wasn't like that, but we had a kind of a similar situation where you woke up when we were sleeping in the desert in India, and there was all those wild boar.
Oh yeah.
And we'd just slept on beds underneath the stars in the desert in northern India, and they were just running rings around me, and I was still asleep. But it was you waking up that woke me up, and you were like, "Look over there," and I'm looking. They're just like, they're like a couple of feet away from us. And then you moved a bit and went, "What are you doing?" And one of these boars just went, absolutely just belted off.
Oh, those things can be scary, though. They get in big packs.
There was a whole family of them, small ones, big ones, and everything. And you got up because we were still laying down when we kind of realized they were around, and you kind of just went, and moved a bit to like look up, and one of these boars had realized that we were there for the first time, obviously.
Yeah.
And just absolutely lost its shit.
Yeah. There were just scavengers came in looking for food and stuff like that into the camp. But yeah, the dog, there was a small dog. It was quite a nervous puppy, I guess. But like, he was just going wild like the whole evening, right? And he was shaking. Like, we had to take the dog into the bed because it didn't know what it was, you know?
Oh,
like,
right.
We thought the dog was chained up, but it wasn't. The dog had backed itself into a corner.
Yeah.
And we thought it was barking because it couldn't get to the pigs, but it wasn't. It was barking to try and get them away from it.
Yeah.
Oh, poor dog.
Yeah. It was like, I've never had a dog cry.
I didn't have that much sympathy for that dog. To be honest with you, but holes in everything, all my clothes.
Yeah, it was a little devil.
He came at you, and it was just teeth out the whole. It was a playful thing. But he was in the middle of the desert and had no one else to play with, so you've got to give him that. It was a puppy. But yeah, just bit everything, bit your hands, stole things from you. Yeah, tried to eat your food.
Wow. Beautiful dog. Well, we should get back to the workaway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I just realized we were going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about your experience here in Hong Kong when you first came here.
So we came to Hong Kong because we have been on the road for a very long time now. So our funds have sort of run out. And we said we really would like to learn about permaculture. We found this lady who, there weren't so many workaway profiles here in Hong Kong, but one of them, which had amazing reviews as well, like saying the most beautiful things about the farm and the woman who ran it and stuff like that. And so she said that she's built the whole garden, you know, from scratch, and everything's all natural, and she's in like a really natural, like, ways of healing and blah, 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 blah. And she grew some fruit and some vegetables in her own garden, and she would teach you about permaculture, and she would have these like courses running, you know, once a week where you can like learn and study permaculture, blah, 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 whatever.
Can you just tell me what permaculture means?
Okay.
Because I hear that, I just think of permafrost.
And I'm like, permaculture is like a method of farming where you basically create an ecosystem that runs on itself.
So you don't have to plan.
I guess you just like let
you help
flourish,
it.
Right?
Yeah, you help it go along. So you, I mean,
so you're not doing any work eventually. Is that it?
Yeah, kind of. Well, there's certain different types of permaculture as well, isn't there? There's ones where you basically just let it run wild, but then there's like others where you can like introduce a pond where the algae in the pond like takes out or puts like nitrogen back into the soil. And
okay. So it's a whole ecosystem.
It's a whole ecosystem which you kind of, with your knowledge of science, I suppose, allow to flourish so that you can grow fruits and vegetables and nothing becomes depleted. It's kind of, you allow everything to have like this symbiotic relationship.
Sounds cool. Sounds idyllic and interesting. And
Okay.
So we thought, what a great opportunity, you know. Yeah. She really sold it really well, and so we kind of came to Hong Kong hoping to stay for like a couple of months, you know, and then do some volunteering. And she said about 5 hours a day, get 3 meals a day, and then get like a couple of days off, and obviously like stay on Lantau Island, beach across the road and stuff like that. So yeah, it was
sounds awesome.
Exciting. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was really excited to learn about permaculture because
both, like,
I think
super
that's
excited,
yeah, I think that's a good way of dealing with any sort of like agricultural problems that we might be dealing with, that we might be heading towards.
So
like
right
race, like, you, like, if you can, if everyone can have personal, like, their own, like, or a small community, like permaculture farms, that'd be perfect. We're not depleting natural resources or anything.
So the plan was to come here, learn how to do it, help them, obviously, work a few hours a day, then they give you a place to sleep,
they give us a place to sleep,
they give you food,
and it didn't particularly work out that way.
Yeah,
so what happened?
Oh God, where do you even begin?
I mean, it wasn't like the worst thing ever, okay? Uh-huh. We just ended up feeling like we're being a bit used, maybe, and like nobody really cared so much whether we were like fed and like we were happy all the time, you know? And I guess like the woman had issues of her own with a family of hers, like her children both were like a little bit mentally unstable, not even a little bit.
There was a lot of negative energy, and there was a lot going on in that house.
And it was strange because I really felt like, and she would talk about energy a lot, right? Well, we know from like just from science, like everything is energy, right? So like whether sometimes you can't really feel it so much, but when you kind of tune into it a little bit more, you feel like when someone's negative, you know, like, I mean, even someone who doesn't even know that much about it, right? If a person's angry, it's like it makes you feel heavy, right? And horrible if there's like anger around you or like hatred and things like that, right? But you turn up at this garden and it feels like, I don't know, it felt a little bit off already.
Like a black cloud. Like a big black cloud.
And it's weird because, like, it's beautiful, you know? There's butterflies all over the place. There's, like, frogs mating and just beautiful green and flowers everywhere, you know? Like, it's just
trees,
a paradise.
Papayas, like, thousands of different species of everything. But
so how could people be negative in that?
Well, it was like a, it's like almost like a rule book, like a play-by-play of, like, a family that had been forced to, like, fused in this space together and deteriorated. And you could just see, like, they lived together in a small area. And, I mean, there's a 17-year-old girl, 21-year-old boy, and then their mother, and then their grandmother when she came to stay. And they all sleep in the same room. And they just jarred against each other a lot because no one had their own space, their own personal space.
Actually, none of them were really working, right?
So they weren't working either.
So,
it was playing video games, headphones into laptops, headphones into their phones. They weren't talking to one another. When they did talk, it was just short, angry bursts at one another. And,
God.
It was really hard because we tried to help Sim a lot more than me. I give up straight away. I'm like, if I gave you advice, you don't take it, you don't take it.
Sure.
But Sim really put herself out there and ended up hurting herself in the process.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, she said she had, like, shamans as friends and healers and people who were, like, kind of, I don't know, trying to, like, help her, I guess, you know? And then, just thought, this woman's pretty cool. Maybe, like, you know, can like chat to her. And at first, you know, the conversations were like really light and like I guess it did seem like pretty interesting and stuff, and I thought, oh, maybe this woman is like open to, you know, getting better. And of course, if you arrive at a place like this and you think, oh, okay, you know, I know some stuff and she knows some stuff, maybe I can help her, she can like, you know, teach me something as well, right? But towards like the middle of it, I thought, okay, this woman isn't actually taking any kind of advice because she really is holding on to some things that she'd learned or whatever she thought that was right. And, you know, and she just like, she finds fault in a lot of, in everyone around her, you know, but like never in herself, right?
So it's quite evident straight away.
And
there wasn't, so we didn't learn about permaculture. None of the jobs were based on permaculture. They were more and when we did ask if we could do jobs like, oh, can we replant that or repot this or deal with the soil, or she would say that she was reserving those jobs for herself because it made her feel better, like it was like a meditative job. But we were to do the liftings. Well, I mean, one of my jobs was that the garden she'd been in for, what, 20 years now? And it was filled, it was 10 years, and it was loads of cement levels. The landlord before was, in typical Chinese fashion, had cemented over everything. So she was opening up the cement, she called it, to then grow everything. And she showed areas before, which is now lush and...
So this works, or it's possible to remove the concrete. And
My job and our job was was to remove the concrete. So you'd spend four or five hours a day bashing up slabs of concrete with a hammer.
Because you didn't have any tools.
No other tools, so just bashing concrete with a hammer, then picking up the pieces and putting them in a sack, and then taking the sack down. About, I don't know, 100 yards down like flights of stairs and stuff, and then disposing of the concrete. Didn't really learn about permaculture because she wasn't in a mental state. When she was in a positive state, she was a delight to be around, but she very rarely was. She was at a migraine. She'd, oh, I've been up all night, I haven't slept, so I'm not gonna help you today. You just go and do this. I enjoy food a lot and I get hangry a lot.
Right.
Well, you know, you digest food within four or five hours, right? So,
and everybody needs to eat, and you're right. out working in the sun and yeah. bashing concrete exactly, all day. Right? You've got to eat a lot.
And there's mosquitoes everywhere, so you really? Constantly get bitten to the point where you are red.
Like there are just, it's like a mist of mosquitoes. I've never seen anything like that.
Oh, you've got about, it's how long has it been? Like 3 days now? Okay, yeah. Got to wait. You're out of the dengue window in about five more days.
Fingers crossed.
Okay.
But the food was minimal.
I mean, you know, the woman had really bad issues with her digestion, so it was like lactose intolerant. She couldn't eat like soy, milk, any dairy gluten. Actually. Gluten, egg. I don't know, eggs was okay.
Eggs was okay.
So she would, you know, cater herself and her family to what she can eat because to cook something that she can't eat.
Understandable in ways, but so in the morning we'd have, in the end we bought our own breakfast. So in the morning we'd have our own food.
Okay.
And then about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, we'd have normally rice from the night before that's still left in the cooker. And then some boiled vegetables, a small amount of boiled vegetables. Mm.
But that's not even the issue, really, because a lot of the times, actually, you don't really know when you're going to get food, you know?
Oh, yeah, also that.
A lot of the times, I got lunch at 3, 4. And a lot of the times, the dinner came at 9, 10, 11 at night.
Oh, wow.
So you are sitting around waiting for food to be ready, but again, you feel like you're a guest, you're a helper, and you know you don't really want to be like, well, when am I going to get fed? You know, whenever she can do it, she can do it. Because what else can you do? There's no supermarket around,
right?
So you're kind of waiting, you know, and then you eat, and then you go to bed.
It was just a bizarre experience.
You're so trapped.
Yeah, well,
trapped was a word we used a lot. Uh-huh. Yeah, and then there's no air conditioning, so our room was. Yeah.
Did they give you your own room or your own house? Or
we had our own room, which was like a saving grace, really. I had our own room with a bed in it. It wasn't particularly big. It was maybe a foot of space either side of the bed, and then a small bathroom with a cold shower. But a cold shower was a good thing.
Well, that's all you need at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
But we didn't have air conditioning. The room was filled with mosquitoes, and we were right next to the pond, which had the bullfrogs in it.
Oh, right next to a pond. Well, that explains the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
No mosquito net?
Oh,
but I don't know. I think, you know, like, we do complain about, like, this, that, and the other. Like, you know, we've done some stuff where it was, like, definitely challenging. And I guess, like, you know, we've slept in, like, really dodgy places. We've been on trains for, like, 40 hours at a time, you know. Mm. So it's not like we're just complaining about every little thing.
Indian train station floors. But
when you're there working every day, right?
Yeah. You guys don't strike me as complainers or anything.
Yeah.
No. But, like, when you're on a train for 40 hours, you've done that. That's your own choice. Yeah. You're not...
But there wasn't particularly any... But, again, I think it's due to her mental state, and maybe she was just in pain, but it wasn't particularly... appreciation. We didn't get a single thanks. You know, when you go, when you realize someone hasn't said thank you, so you think, like, right, I'll know when they say thank you. Mm. And then I was attuned, but we didn't get a single thanks for like 5 hours of work and come over and tell you what you've done wrong.
Yeah.
And then leave. Right. And it's like,
5 hours of unpaid work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then they come over and goes, oh, you haven't done this, that, and the other. And walk off again. It's like, oh.
Why? Because the thing is, right, so if you're a workaway host, right, you want people to do a job for you, and people might not know how you want things done, right? So if you want it to be done right, you have to be there.
Yeah.
You have to be, like, supervising them or, like, I don't know, just do stuff with them, right? Like,
or demonstrate.
You know?
It became quite evident early on that taking any sort of initiative was a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, because she'd come and be like, I didn't ask you to do that, and now you've done it wrong.
So we wanted to do our 5 hours, but we'd like to do it early. But because of her schedule, and sometimes she slept in, or the kids were up, and, you know, like, kind of plugged into mobile devices and all the time, she wouldn't go to sleep until early in the morning, like 2-ish, 3-ish.
Mm.
So she would sleep all the way through. So we'd be up at 7:30, 8, we'd go down to the beach, get our breakfast, we're waiting to work.
Yeah.
We're not given any jobs. We have to wait until she wakes up to get the job to then do the 5 hours. So it
And then you're working in the middle of the day when it's hot.
Exactly, and then your evening's not yours.
Yeah,
so
right.
You have to work through into that as well.
God.
So there was plenty of issues. But then the problem with the work, I think, which we started to realise, is which we spoke about before with the feedback system on like couchsurfing. It's like now on couchsurfing, you leave a they both get was it, you give
it's so you guys are staying here as couch surfers, yeah. And you've done an actual request. So yeah. Then now once you leave, or whenever Couchsurfing thinks you're going to leave, it'll send me a message saying, how was your stay with Sim and Nathan? Mm-hmm. And you get about a week to write them a review. And then I'll write a review, but then you guys can't read what I wrote until you write me a review.
And then it's published.
And I can't read your review either. Yeah. So, and then once we've both written ours, then they both get published at once, and you can't modify them.
Yeah.
So there's no room for, I write you something bad about you, and then you just retaliate by writing something bad about me, even though it's not true.
Exactly. Which, whereas in Workaway, they haven't yet ironed that out. So then, so your Workaway, you go to a host profile and you can go through the feedback that people have left them, and it will be good feedback, but you can see there's people are hinting or warning. There's like certain like buzzwords in it where you realize that they've left a good review because they want to get a good review back, because otherwise it becomes like a negative, like petty tit for tat reviews.
Right.
So the reviews on this were really good, weren't they?
Well, so what kind of advice would you give then for watching out for places like this that are kind of sketchy or just not everything they're cracked up to be?
Is to message people that have worked away, who have left reviews there before.
Okay, so you can see who worked for them previously? Yeah. Okay.
And put some more, do your due diligence a little bit better. Saying that, someone actually messaged me this morning from Workaway who wants to stay at a place that we stayed in. Busan in South Korea, and were asking me what it's really like.
Okay.
So I sent that back, and that was a dream. That was a really good Workaway. Okay. In comparison, we knew what work, what jobs we had to do. The guy who owned the place took us out for food, showed us around, had a good time.
Oh, that's great.
So
I guess you just expect like some sort of communication, you know, when you're there. Mm-hmm. Like you just kind of hang out with them, I guess you learn, and like you don't mind helping. Whereas there it was like we either, you know, are told to do something, and then like, you know, we'll just turn up for food and then we go back out again, or maybe she'll come and be like, okay, you did this wrong, I didn't tell you to do that, you know. And it just kind of felt a bit kind of sad, you know, like instead of 2 months we decided to kind of just run away, you know.
And you were gonna stay for 2 months. Yeah. How long did you end up staying?
Three weeks.
Oh, you stuck it out. All right.
We had vacations in between as well, didn't we? Yeah. You went away camping.
I went away because I really felt like I just at one point I really couldn't handle it anymore. Mm. You know, because a lot of stuff kicked off with the children, because her son. He's going through something really, really difficult, you know, to the point where he's harming himself and talking about suicide, and is really just, you know, imagine coming to a family, you know, to a place like this where, you know, your intentions are good and everything is okay, but then everything, like all the internal family problems are rising up to the surface so fast, and you feel like you are just so not wanted there, but then you're also in Hong Kong, which is like a really expensive place, and it's like really hot and humid, and you don't have anywhere to run away to, right? So I said, okay, I feel really anxious here because I just really feel like I'm intruding, you know, like this family has issues.
In fact, they really did say that we were intruding at some point, like the boy say, like, he just doesn't want Workaways around anymore, which is fair, which is understandable.
Yeah. Okay,
his area isn't that big, and he's growing up and he's going through things. To have to see foreign people's faces come in,
At least he's communicating it.
He communicated to his sister, I think he then said.
Oh, okay.
Not communicate to us. Yeah. Okay. So we didn't make eye contact with him the whole time we were there.
That's weird.
Being
in a room with just you and some other person and
not saying a word.
Yeah, it's so cold.
And I went away, so Sim went camping for a few days and came back, and then I went to serve, to help at a Vipassana 10-day silent meditation retreat, which is just around down the road in Lantau. And I went there for a few days, and part of the retreat is where you all sit in the hall and you meditate together. And I wasn't being silent. I was helping. I was serving, helping in the kitchen and stuff. But part of it is there's a teacher at the front. In this case, there was two because the group was so big. And they do metta meditation, which is like a Buddhist meditation where you meditate to try and create a positive energy where you kind of, inside your head, you're pushing out love towards all beings or love towards everyone in this room. I hope everyone in this room is okay and they find liberation and they find love within themselves. And I hope that they share the love that I found within myself as well. And I mean, since we started traveling, I'm more so. But to be part of that, to be within like 80 or so people, where some of the servers and the teachers are like pushing out positive love and vibes towards people, and you can see people come in there who are unhappy and starting to, you know, take a full breath of fresh air and begin to, it's a silent retreat where you're not allowed to talk to anyone, like your phones or reading material or anything, and you start seeing, like I call it the Vipassana stare, but you start seeing people just staring off into the distance or like following a trail of ants or like looking at a leaf for 20 minutes. Yeah. And you begin to, it's like Earth, it's like life in HD, I call it. Like.
So it's almost like they're on psychedelics then.
Yeah, kind of, a gust of wind and you're like, oh, am I grateful to be around? You know, it all starts coming out that way. But yeah, so I left there after 4 days, I think, to come back. It's a 10-day, so I didn't stay for the whole time, but I came to help set up and everything. And I came back, and one of the first things I did was come in and cook. And I cooked in the small room, and the boy was in there, and just me and him. Mm-hmm. And I had to leave. Like, I couldn't cook anymore. I had to leave. I felt physically sick. Being
just,
in that
just
space.
Being near him.
Yeah, because I think it was such a difference between... That's the first time I've ever really felt anything that strong. And, like, I'm not super spiritual or anything. Mm. But, like, I couldn't be in that room with him. It gave me, like, an instantaneous headache. Mm. I just felt really nervous and anxious and horrible. And I was like, I think it's because I've been in this environment where everyone's smiling and, like, happy and full of, like, love. And
just
then
peaceful,
I've gone straight into, like a really hyper-realized... opposite of that where
it's just not good for you.
Yeah, that's it. The same, I was like, it was a really horrible
but it's like, what can you do? You like, you wanted to help them, but they don't want to be helped, and
they don't want to be helped.
You're not professionals and this kind of thing, and
yeah, God. I guess when you're there inside, you start to actually see things like really clearly, you know, like what the issues are. Not being like, you know, picking on what they're doing wrong, but like, I guess you just kind of end up being like, okay, so this is what's happening, you know, because like, so the mother talks to you and like tells you this is wrong and my children are doing this and that and my mother is doing this and that, you know, and then the mother comes to you and she's crying, the grandma, and she's, you know, and then I suddenly became like this sponge, you know, and everybody would just like tell me stuff and I'd be like, okay, you know, like maybe, you know, trying to get them to see the other side perhaps and being like, I mean, I'm not a mentor, like I'm not a counselor here, but like, again, you know, maybe trying to like say, okay, well, maybe, you know, blah, 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 whatever. Yeah. And yeah, and then it was just like, none of the sides were willing to open up and see, you know, like the children were like, okay, well, we don't mind that people are here, but it's like, come on, you know, like give us at least a couple of days or a week, you know, in between. So we can just be a family and just do our thing, you know?
Because we'd turned up.
And then the mother obviously wants the labor. She wants people to come in and help her out and stuff. So she doesn't... She listens to her children shouting at her, saying like, oh, you know, like, can you stop with this workaway thing? But it just comes in and goes out, you know, because she needs the work to keep going, right? The garden to be maintained. And again, it was just a weird, weird dynamic, you know, like, and we're like, okay, well, do we help? Is it just us? At one point, I really thought, am I just being picky? Am I just demanding for this, that, and the other? Uh-huh. And like, am I just being a princess or something? You know, sometimes these thoughts do come in and I'm like, I mean, I've done worse things, you know, like where I had to really like work my ass off, I guess. But it's just, but then again, you do get paid for it. And here you're just like, crap, like I really don't know whether, you know, I'm in the wrong or they're in the wrong, like what's going on. And
well, you're asking the questions and you know they're not they're probably not asking these questions.
Yeah, that's
and
the thing. Yeah,
you're introspective and that already says a lot.
So
I guess
just
these,
one of those things. Yeah, so
these
then
things
we
come up,
we just left and we just like
get some good ones, you get some bad ones.
Yeah
yeah
but we came in on the tail end of another couple leaving. we must have turned up just after them.
Oh, okay.
And that was already like warning bells because they said, oh, sorry, your room isn't clean. It was messy because the guys were meant to stay here longer, but they've just left.
Oh,
and
right.
Then straight away, then I thought, like, why did they leave early?
Right. Okay.
Huh. Yeah, and didn't even like clean the room, just bailed.
Ah, God. They need some sort of anonymous reporting thing. If it's this bad, like if the reviews are that good and the experience is that bad, there's a real incongruence there.
Yeah.
But yeah, who knows? Maybe we're just unlucky. Maybe it's just a difficult time.
Because it did seem like a particularly turbulent time, and they've got a lot. Mm. They've got a lot to deal with. And when the woman was in a good mood, she really was in a good mood, and it was like a nice place to be. Mm. And sometimes she cooked, like a couple of the meals she cooked were delicious.
Okay.
And fulfilling. So. And there was one time she made me pancakes. And I was like, this is lovely. This is...
So she had some redeeming qualities.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but it was a roller coaster. It really was.
I mean,
it put a big strain on our relationship, didn't it?
Yeah.
I saw that coming in within the first like 2 hours. I said, this is not going to be a nice place for us.
Like, I'll have to think about this because one thing with travel is people ask me all the time, especially back home, like, well, how do you do it? It seems like you do nothing but travel and how can you afford it? Yeah. That's the biggest question I get asked. And I mean, what's worked for me won't work for everybody. I mean, for me, I've just worked at a high paying white collar type job and then an office job and then lived like a college kid basically and then just save a lot of money and spend my money on the road.
Yeah.
But I realize, like other people, they don't have that option, or they're looking for something else. And I can say, oh well, you could do woofing, or maybe you could do work away.
Yeah.
So these are options, and it sounds like at least normally it's a pretty good option.
Yeah. Or you can do it. You can mix it together, like we done a small amount before, where you can like if you're native English speaking country, you can get a TEFL certificate. And then teach English online.
Oh, right.
And then you can be at a workaway which has Wi-Fi and then teach in the evenings.
Oh, okay.
And so then that way you're actually just making money. And it's good money as well, really good money. Like £13 an hour, £13 an hour, which is, that's good money in England.
Well, sure, that's a lot more money than a lot of people make.
Yeah, exactly. So you can do that and supplement and actually make money, which we did a bit in Nepal, didn't we? Mm. Not much, but... yeah, we made some money. Enough to pay for the Indian visa for me, anyway.
Well, you can come out ahead then, at least.
Yeah, like if you dedicate yourself to it.
Yeah, you have to really, you know, like commit to it.
But you could travel forever if you did work away. You would only really need travel. Like some people would take you in like a work away position for like 3 months solid.
Okay.
So you would only need to travel there.
Yeah,
and to pay for your travel costs there, and you could work there for 3 months easily.
And especially if you can get a place where, so they're giving you plenty of food, and then you're only working a few hours a day, and then you've got the whole rest of the day to do whatever.
Yeah, it's like 5 days a week, so you get your weekends, or you get two sporadic days in the week, or 2 days in the week.
Sure. Yeah. So that's one way to do it.
Yeah,
the best advice would just be, just message, you know? I mean, if you can, message people who have already done it at that particular place. Why not just be like, hey, you know, I'm thinking of coming. Mm. Could you give me a little heads up, you know?
Like, yeah, what was it really like? Because your review said food, sometimes delicious or something like that kind of. Like a small amount in it. Like early rises and a few late nights or something, and you like late nights and early rises. Mm. Now what's that about? Or there's like a read between the lines,
right? Maybe you can come up with some sort of like you write something out and it's a code, and when you read it backwards, it says what it really says.
Avoid at all costs.
Right. It's like
I'm sure there is. I'm sure if you went on like a work away forum. I'm sure there is some sort of
like you can play Stairway to Heaven backwards and they talk about Satan and stuff. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Anyway, and couchsurfing, I've never thought about just messaging some random person who also stayed at a house, but I guess that could work.
Yeah, you could do that.
I've just never felt the need, I guess.
Couchsurfing has been really positive along the board for us, isn't it?
Same here. I've never had anything super negative happen. So.
Yeah, they always tend to be the same.
Still good organization.
Yeah.
Kind of people.
All right, so before you guys told me that you're at the end of your trip, and I still haven't even asked you where have you. Well, we've talked about a few places, but where can you just give me the rundown of where you've gone on this trip?
Okay, so
and the timeline too.
Oh no, I couldn't do a timeline.
Oh well, when did you start? I mean,
we started in February 20th last year.
Okay, 2018.
2018.
Okay.
And we flew to St. Petersburg in Russia, and then we. We got on the train. We couch surfing. First couch surfing experience for me. And the guy lost your bag straight away.
Oh yeah.
he was a great guy though. He lost. So he went and picked us up from a bus stop, and then got on another bus with us. And the buses in St. Petersburg and the way that they deal with that was just overwhelming for us. And we had a lot of luggage with us. We came out. We were kind of over prepared for things. It was. Freezing, very snowy, filled with snow, and you just kind of everything's in the Cyrillic alphabet as well, so you can't understand it or even begin to understand it. And Sim knows a tiny bit of Russian because she's Lithuanian, but yeah, we were kind of lost, and we had to try and find a bus, wasn't it?
And yeah, then the guy met her, you know, he came to pick us up, and he was like, oh, you know, well, because, you know, you normally have a small little bag as well as your backpack, and this is where all your money, passport, you know, valuables are and stuff. So he's like, do you want me to carry that? I'm like, yeah, sure. I mean, thanks, you know, like, yeah. I mean, it's small, but if you want to help me. So I was like, yeah, sure. So he takes it, and he puts it on the side on one of the seats. And, you know, we get off this bus, and I'm with my rucksack and stuff, you know, fully trusting this guy. And he just suddenly stops talking, and he goes, shit, I forgot your bag, you know? And we're like...
That had everything in it.
And I don't know, I actually was super chill about it, because somehow deep down I knew that, I don't know what it was, but I just kind of thought, was quite trusting in the
He was, you know, like, in the guy, he had like a super, he was like, oh, lost your bag.
It's such a classic way that travel stories start. It's like you give your bag to someone and like, oh, and that had everything I needed.
Yeah, and okay. And I see this bus going off, you know, in the middle of Russia, like going off to the into the distance, and I was like,
Do svidaniya.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, welcome to Russia, you know? And yeah, so he was like, okay, I'll see you, you know, stay here or something. And he just
found it. Just stay here, I'll go get it for you. Yeah. Just ran.
Ran after the bus.
Yeah.
Oh. And he got it. He actually picked it up and brought it right back to me. So I was pretty pleased with that, I guess.
Okay. So he was legit.
Cool guy, big. And we slept in a bed with him and his girlfriend.
In an actual bed,
like all four of us on a...
It's like a pull-out couch.
Pull-out couch, all curled up.
And next door, right, so before we come, he says, just so you know, I have a dog and two cats. I hope you're, you know, okay with animals. So we're like, oh, sweet, okay. So we turn up, there is a dog and two cats. And then he opens the door to his mother's bedroom. And there is a, I'm not kidding, about 14 animals, right? In cages, all in cages. There's rats, you know, chewing through the, you know, the
cage. There's like a crow, a goldfish,
a hedgehog, like loads of fish,
parrots.
Was she running a circus or something? Or?
No, apparently his mother was just rescuing all these animals.
She'd rescued the animals. She was a teacher at a school. Biology teacher. So she rescues the animals, but then she just keeps them.
She wanted to give them, you know, free them, but somehow they just end up there.
She kind of hoards them.
An animal.
There was an owl, wasn't
there?
Yeah. And the dog was a giant Alsatian. So you let the dog in the room, and the dog just runs up to the cage, and all these birds and everything just fly to the back side of the cage.
So that the animals are not compatible with each other either.
Yeah, it was just like a Tetris type block situation of different types of animals that shouldn't be in the close quarters with one another.
Yeah.
So I recently heard this podcast about this animal or pet tube phenomena. This one girl who basically started it had a similar situation. She was just a really, real introvert and had some sort of medical problem that prevented her from going out for very long.
Okay.
She was in pain all the time, and she started collecting animals and just putting them on YouTube. And here's my pet goat, and here's my chimpanzee, and here's my birds.
Jesus.
And that just became a thing, and her channel just blew up. And so now there's... All of a sudden, there were a handful of these people
doing it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, and it became a sub-genre.
Detrimental.
And so the podcast was following her and going to this YouTuber convention. And I feel so old because I'm like so out of touch with this stuff that all these famous YouTubers that the people would go and gather at this convention and treat them like celebrities. Like they are celebrities.
In a way, but,
Modern day celebrity, then.
Right. And so followed her story. It was interesting. Yeah.
And that doesn't come from a good place, though. Like, that's like,
there's a certain line. Like,
there is a certain, like that's celebrating, I don't know, someone.
Locking animals up and.
Well, she got a lot of heat too, because a couple of her animals died.
Yeah, and, like that's.
They weren't really sure if she had neglected them or what, but then, I don't know, there's all these sub stories too.
That's not a positive story. Mm. That's
no.
that's somebody. I don't know. Like trying to fix the mental health issues they have with something that's definitely more detrimental to their health and others.
But it's
celebrated by. I don't know why I'm surprised.
I'll give you maybe a link to this podcast. But it was a really great thing for me to listen to, because it had like many human stories, that so many positive things and then negative things, like you're saying. But she also couldn't really get a job because she had this medical condition. So she started making money. I mean, for the first time in her life, she's making money on YouTube, and she's actually pulling her weight that way. And she felt really satisfied that she's able to afford stuff. She can maybe move out of her mom's place at some point.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I didn't think about it. But I suppose if it was like an open-air farm or something, it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is just being caged animals.
Internal
caged
animal.
Huh.
A goat and a chimpanzee.
Well, I just pulled those out of my ass. Oh, okay, I don't know if she really had those. maybe she had some weird animals, but I don't know.
Yeah. But then would she then be like, oh, okay, you know, people are watching my channel, so I'm going to get more animals, and I'm going to like, oh, there's more animals. And then, you know, when is that line crossed when everything is done? You know, like cat cafes, right? They're massive. Korea, China, you know, like all these cat cafes keep popping up.
And
initially...
cafe with a cat in it?
You didn't go to a cat cafe before?
No.
There was one in Liverpool just before we were leaving.
So initially, it opens up, you know, because someone has loads of cats and, you know, the government doesn't give a shit, so they don't give you any money. So you're like, okay, well, I can't pull this weight and, like, feed all these cats and stuff. So they open up a cute little quirky cafe where you can come, have a little cake and coffee.
There's cats everywhere.
And there's cats everywhere, you know, and they can kind of run around. There's different levels,
right? They have it, like, built up for cats.
Yeah.
So.
And so you come and, you know, you see these cats and you want to help them and you kind of, you know, pay the money, maybe a little bit extra sometimes, you know, to feed these cats.
Hmm.
But then eventually it turns into this place where more cats are taken on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a tourist attraction because cats are cute, right? Everyone thinks that. Whoever likes cats, anyway. And you come, and then the people bring their kids who
kids
just think,
chase the cats
I need,
into corners and stuff.
They chase the cats. The cats never get peace. They become anxious.
There was one we went to had like, they do have some areas where people can't go.
Yeah. So obviously it has to be, that has to be.
But then how many of those customers are getting a toxoplasmosis? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, right. You're getting ill from like cat piss on their fork or something.
Yeah, yeah. You just get a little bit of that and you've got, like we were talking about mental disorders coming from mold.
Yeah.
You know, that's another one coming from around being around cats.
Yeah, cats
can make you crazy. Because of that disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's so weird.
Yeah, but the thing is, well, you know, the little house on this farm we stayed at, so there was actually quite a lot of mold there as well.
Oh, yeah, so that's what we were talking about when we first came into the
podcast.
Well,
before we started recording, we were talking about that, about mold in this place.
Because we said, hang on a minute, you know, the reason they were behaving in such, like, I don't know, I guess they were all depressed and anxious and, you know, had, like,
quick,
mental issues, you know, would that be connected, you know, because there's mold everywhere in the place, right? In the workaway house,
absolutely,
in the room.
You could feel it, stunk of mold everywhere.
So I just looked
it up.
Mold
on my
says,
stuff at one point.
Yeah, and it says the exposure, you know, like heavy exposure to mold can cause these kind of effects.
Oh, you just looked it up, right?
Yeah, it actually said that on the first
pretty
page.
Pretty much like a list of their symptoms.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And respiratory problems, but also... And
just think how many things we are exposed to on a daily basis, you know? Like, is that partially contributing to the reason.
Yeah, like lead-based paints and getting rid of lead-based paints, and then there being like a massive reduction in crime because the lead and lead-based paints actually it did something to you, like
prefrontal cortex.
Frontal cortex
makes it crazy.
It turns you a bit more apey. Quick to anger, quick to violence.
Right.
Yeah, and the reduction was lead in petrol.
When I was growing up,
they outlawed lead in petrol.
You could still get it when I was a kid. You had regular and then unleaded, so you had the option of getting regular if you had an older car.
For the lead.
Yeah, well, and then petrol just, with it lead.
Just
meant, in it.
It just made people crazy.
Yeah, because if you had an old car. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, but if you had a 20-year-old car at that point, or like, let's say a muscle car from the 60s, and you didn't get leaded gasoline, then the engine would knock. You'd hear loud when you're driving, because those engines need, I don't know why exactly, but they needed lead. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, of course, those cars still exist. You can get an additive, a lead additive for those cars.
Jesus.
But you could just get it right out of the pump when I was little.
Yeah.
God, I mean, I know there's so many of these toxins in society, and you sound a little crazy when you talk about it, but then it's not, because we know that's happened before.
Yeah, it's like scientific. Like,
and what else is there that we haven't figured out yet?
Yeah, it's worse to not talk about it, because then you kind of like, well, this could be a possibility why people are just going a bit more and more mad, right? And if I don't talk about it, then I don't even question it, you know?
Well, it's just that, I guess what I mean by crazy, it's just, it quickly turns into, what's the one, contrails?
Chemtrails.
Yeah, people talk about chemtrails. The planes are dropping chemicals on us, and like, come on, that's completely ridiculous. It's so stupid. Yeah. But then some of this stuff's real. Maybe it's not malicious. Yeah. It's just, it's just how it worked out.
Yeah, there's been like times where they've like reverse engineered areas like populations of villages and stuff have had like cancer, or there's been like sterilization and stuff like that, and they've realized that they've been close to like crop dusting for like pesticides.
Oh yeah, well that would make sense.
That has sterilized an entire village and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you wouldn't then say that was a conspiracy of like chemtrails and stuff like that, but you'd be like, you have all just given us cancer.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do wonder if that happens, like there's like some sort of like crossover there where like those kind of pesticides too close to schools and stuff, and
God, and I don't know.
Does actually make people ill.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know that's happened in Hawaii at the moment, hasn't it? Like with Monsanto.
Yeah.
Oh, they with that
spraying,
lawsuit.
They're spraying, they were just spraying like next, like the fields next to school playgrounds, they were spraying.
And kids were actually falling to the ground.
Yeah, kids were like, like having like blood-soaked coughing fits, and then the field next to it, there were guys in like full like white like hazmat suits.
Oh wow! So they knew even.
Just like, of course, like one gust of wind is going over there. God. Like you're in a hazmat suit. Doesn't anyone that's doing that just turn and go, probably shouldn't do this?
Maybe
like,
there shouldn't be 5-year-olds right over there.
Yeah, right. Like if we have to be this protected.
Yeah, I mean that's the line, right? Like. If you're dusting crops or whatever, and you're spraying chemicals, and you just don't really realize how dangerous that is for people, then that's one thing.
Yeah.
And like, okay, you figure it out, and then you stop.
Yeah.
But then, that's completely different when you've got kids playing around next to hazmat suits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's so obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just the whole following the money. It's just like when they have their lawyers, and they're like, oh, we'll get a lawsuit. Of course, some of them will die, but. It won't affect profits. The lawsuit won't affect profits as much as if we stopped.
That's like what Ford did with the Pinto in the 70s. They figured out with one of their cars was called the Pinto.
Yeah.
And they, when it was just about to be released, they figured out, oh, well, if someone rear ends this car, the gas tank is in a spot that it'll just explode and everyone will get burned to the fiery death. So let's do something about it. And then they did a cost benefit analysis. And realize, well, we're going to get this many accidents and this many people will burn to death. And then we're going to have to pay out this much money from their lawsuits. But it's going to cost more money to fix the gas tanks. So we're just not going to fix the gas tanks. I mean,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. No?
And that's what the guy on Fight Club did, right?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Right, yeah. Right. He was like, when they say, like, how many of these accidents happen? Like,
right.
You wouldn't believe.
Yeah, more than you would possibly believe.
Yeah,
right.
Like,
right.
Who do you work for? Like, what company do you work for? A big one. Yeah, that's what I was
But that was basically what happened with the Pinto.
Yeah, just people just getting burnt alive.
Yeah.
That is just, oh, I don't know. Just everything comes crashing down when you... When stuff like that happens, you're like, oh, I can't believe people do that to one another.
That's really happened. Mm. But of course, time is so weird, because that was like 10 years after we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And we had people dying in car accidents and giant balls of fire. Yeah, and seatbelts were still, you didn't even have to wear a seatbelt.
Yeah.
And like, there were no airbags. And you're just driving around on highways with these machines and just crash into each other all the time.
Faster and faster and... Yeah.
no anti-lock brakes. Winter comes and you just hit the brakes and nothing happens.
Yeah, it's still moving.
And you just slam into a car in front of you and boom, big fireball, and you're all dead. And that was totally normal and acceptable. And that was after we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
Try and understand that one.
Yeah.
It's just priorities, isn't it?
Then again, we'll probably look back at today, like 50 years from now, and go, oh my God, what did we just got into these metal things and drove around? And
we were just archaic. How did they live like that?
Yeah. You got into an airplane and went through the sky. Yeah. You didn't just hook up your brain to the other side of the world. Oh my God, what was wrong with you? What were you thinking?
Yeah. Well, when they have all these debates about automatic cars, like driverless cars and stuff, and they as soon as it becomes safer to drive for all cars to be automated, it'll be like they start passing laws that you can't, like, it'd be dangerous for a human to drive it, so you'd be
at some point it will be
it'll be pushed, you'll be pushed out of the equation, like, you can't drive this because these are, like, less people die in a full automated system than in a human driven system.
Absolutely.
So you can't now drive a car.
Right.
And then that's how, like, automated cars would move along.
It makes sense that we'll get to that point.
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way that when people say, well, you won't be able to drive. Well, right, but you used to ride a horse. And that was the only way to get around.
Yeah.
And then we got cars. And they were better than horses. So horses are extinct now, right?
Yeah.
They're not extinct. You can still ride a horse.
Yeah.
You just can't ride it all the time as your normal thing.
Ride it down the street.
Right, or you could, I guess, but that'd be, that's pushing.
Someone would have something to say about it.
Yeah, I guess you do that in New York or whatever, the carriage rides. But, like, people still do own horses and do enjoy riding them.
Yeah,
it's just
that's true.
On a private property.
Yeah.
And, it's their own ranch. And I think it'll be something like that in the future. Like, you want to go drive? Oh, okay, you can do that. There'll be road networks or a racetrack you can go on.
Yeah. That's true.
Do it like they used to do in ye olden times of the 21st century.
Road rage.
Right. Oh, yeah. What was this thing called? Road rage. Yeah. Oh, let's do that.
Well, with, like, automated cars and stuff, you'd be able to have, like, you could implement like a car share system within it as well. And then you wouldn't have those problems where, there's one person in a car and you're all kind of going in the same direction, but you're all taking up so much space.
I mean, not only that, but think about parking lots.
Yeah.
Or what do you call them? Car parks.
Car parks,
You go to work now and your car just sits there all day.
And that car could be utilized and used to take other people to other areas.
Not only can it drive itself, but if you own it, you can just send it away and it'll make money for you all day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
It's a money-making machine.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to own one, well, that's fine. You could just rent one for a little bit.
Yeah, open someone else's.
Like one of those city bikes, right?
And now you don't need parking lots. Mm. And you don't need the big garages. Yeah. Or maybe you have the garages still, but you can squeeze so many more cars in because they can park right next to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you do get share cars now. I know in London you can get, like, share cars where, like, one street will have a car and you can, like, book time with it.
Mm.
And you'd be like, oh, I want to go to the supermarket on Sunday morning.
But then if somebody damages it and crashes it, who's liable for it?
I have no idea. I didn't really look into it. But I just do remember they have these cars on, like, a couple of the streets with, like, stickers on them and stuff.
Huh. But then even, like, right now, at least in American cities, you tend to have a lane just for parking. You wouldn't need that anymore.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
So whole cities would open up to all sorts of other activity. Like, pedestrians could walk down there, or there could be bike lanes.
Grow vegetables.
Or grow vegetables.
Well, I suppose now, because you'd be right next to cars, won't it?
Well, yeah, I guess you wouldn't want the exhaust, but there, you could come up with a lot of ideas.
By that point, everything's electric.
Right, yeah.
So it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. I actually read about somebody predicting the demise of the oil industry by 2030.
Yeah.
That it's going to just, Saudi Arabia will just completely collapse. And it's just because of electric cars and self-driving cars. Because
that would be like enough to, but yeah, that isn't it like, isn't there like a certain amount of oil in tires?
Well, I mean, I think we'll still use oil for some stuff. I don't know what the percent is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I just had this barbecue and we were talking about plastic today, even it wasn't necessarily with environmentalists or people who were, that's always on their mind, but I think a lot of people are talking about plastic now and what do we do?
Starting to, yeah.
So that just comes up in conversations with just regular folks. And one guy, actually, I have to look into this. One guy told me he saw this plastic that all you do is heat it up to 60 degrees Celsius and it just dissipates.
And disappears.
Yeah, well, not disappears, but just... You put it in water that's 60 degrees Celsius and it just mixes in. And there's no harmful chemicals in it.
Okay. I was going to say, like you're heating it up.
Yeah. And he said there's different, you can get it at different temperatures. Like you can get an 80 degree plastic. I have to look at it to see
what it is. Yeah, that sounds interesting.
But if you could just do that and, I mean, either heat it up or after a month it just dissolves.
Yeah.
Mm. But I mean, wouldn't that be transferred into the water?
Yeah, if there's no toxicomic chemicals, it doesn't matter.
Right, apparently it's not. Apparently you could just drink that water and it wouldn't hurt you. Because it is transferred in, but the stuff that it was made out of wasn't toxic to begin with.
Okay, I guess.
Apparently. I mean, if we can get something like that, wow. And it's not crazy expensive. Would really change things.
Definitely.
Because, I mean, if you're in the United States or a lot of parts of the world right now and you're in some suburb, the only time you see trash is in the bin, right?
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, you and I, all three of us have traveled a lot, and you go to a lot of Asia or anywhere in the developing world, you see a lot of trash.
Yeah. You go to Lantau, you see it washed up on the beach every day.
Washed up on the beach, comes over from...
Yeah. I saw period pads, I saw straws, like loads of straws, I saw like ice cream, ice... popsicle like packets, just plastic, coming in from China every day. We've gone to the beach to pick litter every day.
Yeah, and then they have beach cleaners there, but the beach cleaners they just have a strange way. They just clear up the organic matter.
Oh, okay.
They scoop up the shells because they think
driftwood and stones, and then throw them behind them.
Okay, so they're doing the opposite of what they should be doing.
Bizarre, right?
Okay.
Well, I'm sure they pick up litter too, but they probably end up putting it all together.
But yeah, they do. They clean up all the organic stuff that's floating in the sea.
Oh, okay.
Washed on the shells and the pebbles that come through, which is, I don't know.
Where it was really apparent and obvious was after the typhoon that came through here last year. Just all that stuff washed up on the shores everywhere, and it just took months to clean it out. And now it's finally, the place is looking back to normal now, but...
Mm-mm.
Oh, there's just so much garbage and plastic everywhere. It's just depressing. Yeah. And it's like when you drink a bottle of water and just throw it out, that goes somewhere.
Yeah.
It ends up in the ocean next to Hong Kong or whatever.
Yeah.
I can't believe that they don't recycle the... I mean, I know in other places they do, but I learned recently that in Hong Kong you guys don't recycle the... like the Tetra Paks, whatever they're called, where you get
the cartons.
Oh, I don't know. I think the recycling system here, from everything I've heard, is not very good at all.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
There was actually on the beach in Lantau, we witnessed the lifeguards and the guys that work at the beach pick up the, you have the big bins where you have plastic, you put plastic in one and paper in the other and tin in the other, and they picked that up and emptied it all in one spot.
Mm.
So other people have been segregating it.
Yeah.
And then they just picked it up.
Oh, they just take it all and just dump it together.
So do you think in a way it's just one of those tricks to make you feel good?
Almost like a placebo type thing. Yeah. The way that Starbucks says that, you pay a little bit extra, but we help the farmers. And that's your way of thinking you're ethically friendly when you buy Starbucks. Okay. But it's like within the cost.
It's like reverse incentives. It's like Freakonomics does a lot of these where you... you think you're helping out and somehow and exactly the opposite of what you wanted to happen happens.
Yeah. It's like a marketing tactic now. They know that they're like to be like some big companies, they know that being environmentally friendly is something that is on people's minds.
Oh, right, so right.
They add that part in as well. So you're like, oh, I'm helping. Like even subconsciously, you think that you're helping, but realistically, you're doing as much damage as you were the first time.
Or they'll say like a portion of all proceeds go toward this foundation.
Exactly.
So, oh, great. Well, if I buy this thing, then I'm helping. And
in England, we had recently. We used to get all our plastic bags for free from the supermarkets or major supermarkets. Our plastic bags were always free, and then our government to look green. And I'm supposed to get some green votes. Introduced the plastic bag tax. It was called.
Yeah.
Where now you have to pay 2p, 3p, 5p for a bag. But the way they worded it was like it was a tax that goes to the government that then tackles climate change. But the money actually just goes to the supermarkets. So the supermarkets lobbied the government.
Yeah.
To charge for the plastic bags, so the supermarkets now make a fortune on all the plastic bags that they sold that they would have done for that they would have given away for free beforehand.
Okay.
And the government gets to look green. It's like a win-win for all the big players out there. And
we get to pretend we're helping.
Yeah, and we all think that
if you just can't stop plastic bags altogether and offer alternatives, you know, for those I wouldn't mind paying, and if it was to pay every time, you'd probably be a bit more careful, like to bring one of your own next time, right? Now a lot of people actually end up being like, oh, you know, I know it's, I always forget that you have to pay for it. So you end up actually, you know you're not doing the right thing by buying these plastic bags continually that are not recyclable. And then you have to end up paying out of your own pocket for it as well. So it's just like,
Well, it can get even worse because I've had this happen a bunch of times where I go to the grocery store. And I go, oh crap, I forgot my bags, so I don't have anything. Oh, well, I'll just buy a reusable bag and then I'll use it again next time.
Yeah.
And I take that home and then next time I repeat.
Just end up having higher quality bags.
Yeah, right.
Knocking around.
Right. Now I've got 50 of these still plastic or still not great material bags that I can, but I can keep reusing them. I've only used them once.
Yeah.
But we mentioned Starbucks before. They have actually started making the little paper straws, haven't they?
They do have paper straws.
And like the little forks and spoons or whatever. So at least Starbucks are.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Made a tiny step towards something.
Before I talked to you guys, when I was at that barbecue, someone said they were at, like, they used to go to Starbucks and get a muffin and get a coffee, and they'd put it on a wood tray and bring out a ceramic mug of coffee.
Right.
And now they go there and get the same thing, and they put it on a plastic tray or put it in something they're going to just throw out. Then they put the coffee into a regular cup, a plastic or a paper cup with a plastic lid. Give them a plastic fork.
We wouldn't really know. We don't.
I don't know either.
Starbucks people.
It's like they've gone backwards. They've just realized it costs more for labor, or maybe to wash the dishes, or just lazy.
Oh, are they like, okay, well, we're gonna invest more into paper straws for you guys, but we're gonna use, plastic trays or something.
Yeah. I don't know.
Is this just overwhelming, isn't it?
It is, and. It's just, we shouldn't talk about this because it's just so depressing.
I always end up thinking, leave this conversation now?
Right. Just everybody listening, just try to use less.
Yeah. You
know? Anyway. Just
tend to the garden you can touch.
Yeah, exactly. So I was asking you guys about your trip and I got sidetracked.
Oh,
right?
My God. Yeah. So,
give me the 30 second overview.
So, St. Petersburg, Trans-Siberian through Russia. We got off at Baikal. Baikal? You say it?
He never gets it right.
I never get it right.
He goes Baikal.
Lake Baikal.
Lake Baikal.
Down there in the ding dong in Russia.
Exactly. Was it
Baikal?
Baikal.
Yeah, Baikal.
That's close. Yeah. We got there when it was frozen. So we got to ice skate on there and drive 4x4s on there and stuff. And then into Mongolia. Stayed in Mongolia for a month. Did a work away there at a bakery. Got to make bread in the morning and go and deliver it in a van. It was fun. And then from Mongolia, we flew to Japan, North Japan, to see the cherry blossoms. And then we hitchhiked and we wild camped down north, down from North Japan through to the bottom of Japan. Got a ferry to South Korea, like Busan from the bottom, made our way up to Seoul. Flew from Seoul to Taiwan. Went around Taiwan. That was beautiful.
Did a
loved.
Workaway there.
Did another workaway.
Two workaways.
Yeah, the first one wasn't actually on workaway,
yeah,
was it? But
yeah.
That was a good one. And then from Taiwan to Nepal. And then Nepal into India. And then India to here.
Okay. Mm. Oh, we've had fairly similar trips, actually.
Yeah,
well, when you put it like that, I mean, I'm sure our experiences have been different. But
But no, same kind of places, yeah.
Right.
Recently, you guys seem to have covered almost the same country.
Yeah, it's just add a little bit of China and then add the Philippines and Sri Lanka. And we went to the same countries.
Same thing,
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's been a really good trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it. And
we did rely on couchsurfing quite a lot.
Did you?
Not really rely, I guess. We just thought, we'll see if we can do it, you know? Yeah.
We did couchsurfing all the way through Russia.
Yeah.
Couchsurfing in Mongolia. So we didn't stay with anyone apart from couchsurfing in Russia.
Oh, wow. That's, okay.
Mongolia, I think we had like one night in a hostel and we were there for a month.
No. That was not Mongolia. That was Russia.
The very last stop in Russia. We had one night.
It feels like Mongolia, right?
Yeah, it was
Ulan-Ude.
Yeah.
We're on the edge.
Buryatia.
Yeah.
That's the area of Russia. It's Buryatia.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then Japan, a small amount of couch surfing, but it was quite difficult, especially when you get to Tokyo and stuff. I couch surfed in South Korea, and the woman went to Vietnam and left me in charge of their cat for like nine days.
House sitting.
Oh wow!
So I was house sitting eventually, which is cool.
Okay, is that what you wanted to do though?
Yeah, because I just wanted to save some money and like base myself for a little bit. And it was right in South Korea. You can get everywhere because it's such a small country that I just went hiking every day. Just left in the morning, hiked all day, came back.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, fed the cat again, laid around watching TV.
You weren't just thinking all day like, "Don't kill the cat, don't kill the cat."
The cat was. Yeah, kind of cold towards me, to be honest.
Well, that is the nature of the cat.
What's sad about it?
Imagine that.
just a bit of a lump of a cat, actually. Just liked the food.
Did you leave a bad review?
Just wanted the food. No. And I just watched Korean revenge films, like all those.
What's that mean?
Oh, they were amazing. Oh. They're films where... protagonist that you quite quickly fall in love with is wronged and then enacts revenge on a bunch of people that have wronged them.
It's like a Kill Bill type movie.
Pretty much. Yeah. But way more brutal. And there's loads
more
of layers.
More brutal than Kill Bill.
Yeah, yeah. And there's loads of layers where there's times where they'll enact revenge and you're on their side, and then you realise that the people that they've hurt and they're acting revenge upon did what they did to the first person through another, and you end up falling in love with both sides and three sides and four sides of these people that are acting revenge upon one another, and you realise they've all been wronged, and they probably should just shake hands and say sorry. But they're not. It's this domino effect of evil towards one another and revenge. But it's really well put, and there's always like some sort of twist. Like, have you ever seen Old Boy?
No?
Okay.
Is that one of them?
That's a more famous one. It got westernized. It's a guy that gets he gets like drunk or like chloroformed, I think, and he just wakes up in a small room of like a windowless room where he's fed and not given much for like 14 years. And then he's released and he's revenge on the people that have like captured him.
So they don't ever get into why he was captured?
They do.
Oh,
and that's the whole.
Oh, okay.
And there's like a big twist as well. And it's good. It's a good film.
He was a cat the whole time?
He looked like a cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big drunk guy he was.
Okay, well, maybe I'll check that. Is that the one that you'd recommend if I want to just watch one of these?
No, I'd recommend Sympathy for... Oh, I can't remember it, sorry. It's like Sympathy for... No, I can't remember. Sorry.
I have to look it up.
Sympathy for the Killer or something. That one was amazing. That one was really good.
Oh, all right. Well,
I'll find it.
I'll just look up the genre.
Yeah. Korean revenge films.
Hmm. Okay.
I got really into it. I just really enjoyed it.
It's like, oh, what did you do in Korea? Just watch revenge films with a cat.
And ate those tiny melons that they have there. They have these melons which are like kind of like cantaloupes. Is it cantaloupes and melon?
Cantaloupe is like a different family, I guess.
Yeah, but they have smaller versions of it. And they're just like hyper delicious. They're just like intense. And you peel them and then cut them and just eat them cold. Oh my god, that was something else.
Yeah, we could just make another podcast about fruit, just fruit, nothing else, mm-hmm. I guess.
Oh yeah. I remember my first mooncake in China. There's these little cakes that they eat in the fall in the Lunar Festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have them in Taiwan as well.
Oh,
right?
They do.
Yeah.
Well, when I first got, because that's kind of his China.
Yeah.
Getting there.
Yeah. When I first ate one, I just popped it in my mouth. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, that was good. And then someone said, well, that would normally feed a family of four. I'm like, oh, sorry. You're supposed to divide it.
Bumbling white guy.
Why are there no instructions on the packet, right?
Yeah, they just looked like a bite-sized thing to me. So.
Yeah, they are small, aren't they? Yeah. I would have.
Well, aren't they about how big are they?
Not particularly large.
Like a diameter. I can barely fit all this in my mouth at once. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
we got one when we were there, didn't we?
Hmm.
Have you ever tried? You've tried mochis, right?
Mochis.
The glutinous rice dessert.
They
sell them down at Park and Shaw.
I know what you mean now. I just didn't know what they're
Fusion,
called.
Yeah. And I've never really tried them before. And then we went to Japan and then we found them really cheap somewhere. So we're like, oh, you know, we'll try this. Mm. And then the first bite was like, well, I'm not sure how I feel about this. You know, the texture of the glutinous rice was a bit like kind of dough, right? Like uncooked dough.
Oh, well, sometimes they'll put actually dough around that. Or they'll... roll it around, maybe.
Yeah, like roll it in sesame seeds or something.
Yeah, but it's just glutinous rice, right?
Yeah.
But then, at first I really wasn't sure about it, but then we kind of got really hooked on it, you know. So sometimes you buy a packet for like a US dollar or something, and then you just kind of go wild with it, you know, just finish the whole thing. And
somebody told
us, right, that one of these mochi balls is equivalent to a whole rice bowl. Because the rice is ground up into a fine powder, and that's how you get the whole gluttonous sort of.
I was eating eight of those a day.
And we're like, oh my god, why didn't no one told us about that? You know,
a lot of calories.
Yeah, man, it's just a bomb, really.
Oh,
and we wonder why we were a little bit plump.
Sounds like my kind of food.
Yeah,
I remember like when McDonald's started putting, in the U.S. they started passing laws that they have to put up calorie counts for all their food.
Right.
And I think it's meant to be so that you get lower calorie stuff. And for me, it's like, oh, cool. So what's the most calories I can get for the least amount of money?
Yeah. It's the equilibrium here.
How can I get as many calories as possible?
And okay.
I don't think that was their intention.
No, definitely
that's
not.
That's another one of those like Freakonomics things. Like you think you're doing one thing, but you're doing something completely different.
You're not. Those mochi balls are... There was something else.
Oh, it's great. I love food that has a lot of calories in a small amount. Peanut butter, and because it can give you so much energy.
It's definitely good for trekking and stuff. Like you grab the high calorie thing. Like when I first met Sim, I used to have always have a jar of peanut butter in my bag.
Mm-hmm. Just spoon
it out. I would just stop mid doing something with a spoon and just eat a couple of spoonfuls of peanut butter and then put it back again.
Yeah, I'm that way too.
It's interesting you say that because, I don't know, I think most people would be like, because peanut butter is so like delicious and Moorish, right? So you want more and more of it and then you're like, okay, well, I really should be stopping now because this is my daily recommended dose.
Yeah.
You know, this is essentially could be 3 meals a day and I've just, you know...
Yeah,
polished it off.
Yeah, and like... You know, 3 teaspoons. So it's a bit dangerous. A bit of a dangerous game.
Right.
Get a banana as well when you scoop it straight onto the banana.
Oh, yeah.
Don't get me started.
Well, I mean, if you're sitting around doing nothing all day, then it's dangerous. But
you just have to then make sure you're doing exercise.
Yeah. I mean, I've never really worried about that when I'm traveling because I'm always carrying 20-kilo backpack and 25, and just every day, just walking for an hour a day with that thing.
It's like enough. You've warranted your three big spoonfuls of peanut butter there.
Sure.
It's when you start basing yourself for a small amount of time is when things start getting difficult. Like our weight since we've been traveling has just been fluctuating.
It has?
Yeah, we got really bad food poisoning in so Mongolia and Japan we put on quite a lot of weight because we were eating like rice and soy and like noodles and stuff in Japan, all the cheap stuff that you can get. And then in Mongolia they had nothing to feed us really, so we ate at the bakery. We ate just like a loaf, we'd have like a loaf of bread each a day, and then they would feed us. Because in Mongolia the men are big and strong, but they're also giant in the way that they're strong, but I wouldn't say fat, but they're like big guys,
meaty,
like a presence. And then like so someone like me, it was always like offensive that I wasn't eating. So they make things that's like almost like a pasty, which is so it's like bread, and then they would put mashed potato inside mashed potato inside, and then like fold up with their fingers, so kind of like a half moon type shape. And then fry it in oil, like deep fry it in oil, and then serve it to you with chili sauce or ketchup or something like that. And they would these things are like, I don't know, like 20 centimeters across by 10 centimeters, something. They're quite big, and they would serve you like 10 to 12 on a plate.
Oh, wow.
And sit and watch you eat it. And they're like, keep going, eat up. I'd have those like with that a day, including like the... the loaf of bread. And yeah, we didn't do a particularly large amount of work, so we got big. And then same with Japan, although we were walking around a lot, we did eat a lot as well. And then we got to Taiwan and we both got food poisoning, really bad food poisoning. And then
I think lasted about 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, and just lost everything.
Both
just
of went you.
Skeletal. Oh, yeah, wow. Just really. And I just shaved my head as well. Oh. So it was like this double, like I looked ill.
Okay,
really
right.
Ill.
Oh, right.
And then got to Nepal, kind of like a healthy weight, and then
went to the mountains,
like milk teas and dal bats and all the cheap curries
and
the curries that you could get, and then India as well afterwards, and the cheap food, you just eat loads. And
I guess you know, when you're traveling, it's not particularly easy to have healthy eating habits, right? Because it's, you know, you eat what you're given a lot of the times, or you eat what's available, or you eat what's, especially being like vegetarian and stuff, you know, it's like next to impossible in some countries. So it's not easy.
And there's no regular food. Routine.
Exactly. And it's like exercise, and it's a lot more difficult as well. Like you can get it done in quite a lot of places, but just being able to exercise, at least like high intense exercise that you'd need to be able to burn excess. Excess weight is difficult to do.
It's just strange that my own personal experience has been quite different with this, with food and weight and all that. Because just when I went to South America, I have to tell you the pounds, but I weighed 188 when I left, and then within about a month I was down to 154. And so
it dropped off
the 34 pounds. So just doing the quick math, like 16-17 kilos I lost in the first month.
Yeah.
And then I just had some extra weight from at home.
Yeah.
And I just stayed at that weight. And so that's like 70 kilos. And I just stayed at 70 kilos for years. Until the very end when I lost some more weight from an illness. But it just like didn't matter what I did.
We get to like one place, it's like, have you tried the mochis? Shall we get some mochis? Shall we have another cup of tea in the mochi?
And it all goes downhill.
Yeah, it goes a bit downhill.
It depends, right? Bodies are so different, right?
Of course.
If I don't eat for, you know, like one window, then next time I eat, my body's like, you know, I've got to take everything out of this food, you know? So it's like, it's just an endless topic, really. It just really depends on who you are.
Quite a lot as well. So like giving up the smoking. Then also like trying to cut down on caffeine. Because if I like let loose, I'll just drink coffee and smoke cigarettes all day. And then won't eat. we'll have like a couple of bananas or something. So like cutting down on the cigarettes and then cutting down on the caffeine. Now I'm like, oh, I'll have some bread.
And so you wouldn't recommend that as a way to lose weight? Just smoke cigarettes all day and then, drink coffee?
No, because then you become dependent on that. And then that becomes an issue.
Do not try this at home, children.
Yeah. I used to drink a lot of those energy drinks as well.
Oh, God, those are... Yeah.
Monster?
Yeah, I was unregulated. Giant. I used to drink cans and cans.
Especially the originals, because they had so much sugar in them.
Oh, yeah. I'm about to drink them now. Give me a headache. But yeah, the original, that green one, used to drink like on a normal day, maybe five.
What?
I know, right?
Five?
Yeah.
That's like a lifetime supply.
Yeah, five of those things, and that it was just like mainlining, like it was like limitless. No, a film, like, it was just like, I drink one of those and I go, I can do everything all day. And then,
I crash,
and then I drink another one, drink another one.
Yeah, that was the one we met, and he told, I'd always see
I wouldn't eat much at all. That was just like, I'd have a few of those a day and I would eat like barely anything.
Wow.
And yeah,
it's one step below crack.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's on the level. Like, having stuff like that obviously is like a problem. And then started cutting down, and Sim helped me cut down, and I don't drink fizzy drinks anymore. But it took me a long time to get off that kind of sugar type rush. Like, I definitely have a problem with sugar.
Yeah, well, it's right. It's so easy to have that too.
Yeah.
I remember like having a go at you. I was like, are you crazy? Like, you can't do that. You can't drink so many cans a day. So then a few times I think that you were just kind of doing it on the sly.
Because you could get one, they're normally like £1.50, but in England you could get like, they'd have deals with £1. So I'd buy loads and just stock the fridge up with them.
Well, travel can sometimes be good for kicking these habits too, because you're just not around it anymore.
Yeah.
Although for other things it's bad, like smoking. If you're a smoker and you're trying to quit, and then some parts of the world, they just smoke like chimneys. Exactly. And
Nepal, I got up to like smoking 20 a day again. Because it's just so cheap.
You're just around it all the time.
Same with India. It's like, it's so cheap. You come here and it's like, there's no way I'm buying cigarettes.
Yeah. You're allowed to bring 19 cigarettes into Hong Kong.
19?
19. You're not allowed to bring a full pack. You have to smoke one.
Okay.
From outside, because they tax them so much here.
In Australia, like, it's pretty much impossible to smoke there now.
Oh, right.
Because they priced it up. So they priced it so that anyone born in 2000.
Uh-huh.
No, by 2018, anyone that was able to smoke wouldn't be able to afford to. So that meant that, like, they started it in 2000 and they got up. So in 2018, pound-wise, about £30, I think, for like a pouch of cigarettes.
It's crazy. I
mean, so it gets to the point where it's like, you would never even consider doing that because you don't have the money.
I read this opinion piece once and said, okay, smoking's bad, everybody knows that, so let's just make it illegal to smoke because it's so bad for you, and that'll be great because people won't smoke anymore. And then this is like the first few paragraphs, just why it would be so great to ban smoking. And then he said, oh yeah, except then the people who are doing it already, they're addicted and they can't just stop, so now it's illegal, now they have to go underground and these giant black markets open up, and now you have to like commit crimes to get cigarettes. And he just kept going on and on, and then it was pretty obvious he was tying it into the drug war. That's just what happens when you do these things. These are the unintended consequences. And even if it's not an unintended consequence, at some point, like, look, you're just picking an enemy. You're just making an enemy as the smoker, and you're blaming all of society's problems on them. And like, let's just tax them.
Yeah.
Let's make them pay.
Yeah.
But they're addicted, and they can't just stop.
Yeah.
Cigarettes have to be one of the most addictive things out there.
Definitely.
Well,
But I mean, you know, like, take weed and psychedelics, for example. And I think it was on the Duncan Trussell podcast not that long ago, you know. Like, if you were to make it all legal and actually regulate it, then, you know, everything would just change dramatically, you know. Because it is illegal, people don't know how to use it. People end up abusing it. There's a lot of illegal stuff going on, you know. The underground
you don't know what you're getting.
Dealing and stuff exactly. So you just, you know, that's what we all see it as, like, the worst thing possible to happen to humanity. But then it's actually none of those things at all, you know? Like, it's all just
the whole American war on drugs, wasn't it? And the whole the pushing all categories of drugs into one.
The tide does seem to be turning on this whole thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's been like a generational gap, hasn't there? Yeah. And now I think people that are coming up are starting to, like, and now they kept them in for PTSD.
Now there's probably like 5 or 6 states that have legal marijuana, and then the rest of the country's seeing, oh yeah, things aren't just falling apart in those states, they're actually pretty good. And so, well, maybe we should do that.
Yeah, and they like decriminalized like mushrooms and stuff, like
psilocybin. Right, I think in California they have.
Yeah, done it recently. And then like Portugal's like decriminalized all drugs, didn't it?
Yeah, and so then everything worked out well.
Everything was fine. Everyone's just like, like drug dealers don't need to kill each other anymore, and all of that crime side goes down, and people get help. That the money that would normally go towards, I mean, it's pretty common knowledge now, but the money that would go towards like locking those people up goes to helping the people that are addicted to drugs, and classing it as a problem of society and like like health, as opposed to it being some sort of something that's criminal.
Well, anyway, so I think we should wrap this up pretty soon and like, go get a barbecue or get our food for barbecue.
We were talking about food then, and I was like, my god, food comes up a
lot. But this is a travel podcast, so let's see. Can you just tell me? I mean, I know this is so stupid to ask, but like, what can you just give me one good experience you've had in the last year, and just maybe just talk about, or I'll even give you a choice because I see you're kind of hesitant.
All right, okay.
Or what's your best piece of advice for people who are thinking about traveling but just don't quite know how? Like, what should they do to make it happen?
To make it happen, it seems like cliche, but just do it.
Well, right, just do it.
Just do it. Like, there is so much more support out there than you think there is going to be. Mm. Like, when you're worried about, like, oh, I've got to pack my bag, or do I have too much? Like, I'm going to be on my own, it's going to be hard to make friends and stuff. You turn up at the first hostel, like, within, like, 20 minutes, you can find some people, and you just grow as a person. You just find out who you are as a person in all the ways that you're hoping that you will. And all the ways that you are unexpected to you at the moment as well.
And also perhaps maybe like, you know, like the whole idea of like people wanting to always control their life so badly, you know, like pre-planning everything so badly that there is just no wiggle space, you know, wiggle room or anything like that, you know. So I think same applies for traveling, you know. A lot of the times people think that if you want to have a successful journey or trip, whatever, then you have to like know everything of where you're going to be, where you're going to get. There's, you know, to an extent, of course, you have to plan. You have to know how if it's dangerous or whatever. But to pre-plan it and you know, you're potentially shutting yourself off from a lot of beautiful experiences, you know, because if you go to a lot of the places where there's a lot of travelers, then you're bound to meet someone who's just come from that direction. And, you know, we talked about this on the trek yesterday as well, right? Just kind of, you know, talking to people and, you know, just letting them guide you, I guess, you know, and taking advice off others. And because, you know, if you think you can control everything, then, you know, you're totally wrong, because a lot of the times you end up planning and things don't really go that way anyway, you know. So as long as you're smart and you have your wits about you, you know. And
and you're always just looked after. You always think it's going to be scary out there, because when you have your comforts around you, and there's a lot of like fear-based type, like, you know, everything that isn't in your comfort zone is something to be scared of. Like, oh, you go to this country, you'll get robbed. I thought of India from the outside. I thought, we might get robbed, or there might be some sort of damage, like, you know, like, I might be getting into like sticky situations and stuff. Never. Like, those things happen. Like, they happen everywhere, and they were way more likely to happen to me where I lived in England. Actually, they did happen to me when I lived in England. India, fine.
Yeah.
Surrounded by people staring at me, having like high value items on me when everyone else around is poor. Totally fine. They don't care, man. They're lovely, beautiful people. They enjoy what they have, and they don't want to take your stuff. Everyone's lovely. Everyone's beautiful, and that's what you find when you go out traveling. That people look after you, and you're way more likely to attract and bounce into positive people that are there to help you than any negative people.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people in this world are good.
Yeah, and that's what you start to realize. Right. That's like what you realize. You go like, well, I can't believe I had such a fearful outlook of the world mm-hmm. and everyone outside. When you realize, yeah, the people are like, oh, you know, I've done this and I've got this for free if you want it, or like, I'll help you for no reason whatsoever, but just because you're a human, I'm a human, and we're all experiencing it.
Yeah, and I mean, together. You know, we spoke about Workaway, Couchsurfing, woofing. There's like help hacks, you know, if you wanted to make your maybe trip a little bit longer and like, just, I don't know, I guess like not spend your money so fast and learning something as well is like the best way to do it. And a lot of the times, you know, it can even be someone you met who would ask you to go and, you know, come help out, stay with them, whatever. And maybe it's even better because then you have nothing like a, you know, work away where you said you would come and stay for that long, you know. It's not like a contract or anything. Then you have maybe a bit more freedom to say, okay, I'm going to go now, you know.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes, you know, a lot of the times, like woofing, you know, you tell them exactly how long you're going to stay there for. And then 2 weeks like in, you're like, I don't want to be here anymore, you know. But, like, I've kind of said to these guys that I'm going to be here. They haven't taken anyone else on, you know. So, I don't know, just be open, talk. Sometimes we say, like, you know, I think we said to you even, you know, because we're in kind of a bit of a trouble, and we said, like, I don't really, you know, like, sorry, like, I don't really want to ask you to stay for long. And I said, like, yeah, maybe we'll just, like, cook or whatever, like, you know, give you something in return. Yeah. And just a few people a message saying, like, you know, we'll do anything around the house, you know, do you want us to, you know.
Yeah, if you cook, ask, look after your children. You ask, there's always, like, a nice answer that comes from
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
like,
you know.
Yeah, uh-huh. Don't be scared to ask for stuff. Travel overland.
Ah, good. Yeah,
yeah. Travel overland all the time. It's cheaper. You see more things. Uh-huh. You're more likely to serendipitous encounters, and you don't get that shock of like being feeling like you've been dropped into a country and having to deal with airports and packing all your things and travel overland.
Or by sea.
Yeah, or by sea.
Cross borders, even overland. That's interesting.
Yeah, so much, much nicer experience. You kind of blend into a country, don't you? You kind of see how countries aren't particularly borders, but are just like hues of different types of cultures and personalities.
Right, there's like the estuary in the middle that these border towns tend to be.
Yeah.
They're very interesting places.
Yeah, and you learn like what a kilometre is. And things like that. You become good at reading maps.
You get all cocky because you know what a kilometer is. And then people start hating you.
Yeah, exactly. You can't understand how people wouldn't understand kilometers and distance.
Inside jokes,
folks.
And
always try to do. Yeah, well, I think work away and stuff like that's helpful. But always try to live with the locals or do a local thing. Don't stick around the hostels and do your trip advisors.
Or especially the big hotels, resorts.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, man, that's definitely not the thing for us.
And write down recipes or things you've learned about cooking.
Oh, okay.
To impress all your friends when you get back home. This is how I learned how to make Indian chai from some lady in the mountains somewhere or something. I know you do that, didn't you? You got like how to make onion chutney from Baba on a farm in Hokkaido and stuff like that.
In a way it's really good to maybe have a few things that you would like to learn in a particular country,
yes,
right? Because like we've left a country before and we've been, you know, South Korea, and I still think to this day, like, damn, I really wish I learned like Taekwondo or something, you know, like it would just be such an awesome thing. But at the time we're just like, nah, you know, we'll just blah blah blah, knock around, and you know, sometimes you kind of do feel a bit bad because like I was there, you know. And in Japan, like, you know, I didn't, Kung Fu, you know, whatever. Like, just as an example, of course, but.
Right. Try and read books that are from that country.
Okay, yep, good.
Like, if any fictional books or non-fictional books, but, yeah, because then the imagery that is portrayed especially within fictional books from writers that have come from that country, you are immersed in those books.
Mm-hmm.
You're immersed, sorry, in that country, so when you read,
You get another layer.
You do. You're like, oh, I understand that. I understand they talk about people dressed this way, and you're like, I've seen those people. Anything else?
Well, I would just say the flip side of the learn new things in each place, like, that's great advice, but also accept that you cannot do everything.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's been a really that's been a tough one for me. You can
run around like crazy for a couple of weeks, like you're on vacation and just doing everything possible and seeing all the tourist sites, but that'll just get old so fast. So at some point you just have to accept, like, I'm just not going to see it at all.
Yeah.
If you find a place that you like, just like, and you feel, and you have time, just base yourself there for a bit. That's always good for you. It's good for your mental health as well, I think. Mm-hmm. You see mental health and your physical health goes all over the place sometimes when you're traveling. You're just moving from bit to bit, and sometimes it's good to just sit down and
bit of stability.
Just yeah, there's nothing grounded, wrong you know? With routine, because you get, and like I know back at home, and we've spoken about this before, where it's just like I living out of a bag and moving around a lot, and you become almost an enemy of routine, and you're like, oh, I don't want to do routine because that's your 9 to 5, and then that's, you know, then you get your credit card and your mortgage, and that's how your life slips by. But there's nothing wrong with getting routine sometimes for your health and being like, oh, I wake up at this time every day, or, you know, I'll do exercise at this time, and that becomes nice. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with finding that balance. Mm-hmm. Your body needs routine, and your mental health, it needs some sort of level of routine. So don't be scared to build some sort of structure. Also have no structure for a while. That's fun. Or flip between the two, but yeah, don't try and run from having structure, because it's good for you in places, definitely.
All right, guys, well, great advice, lots of it.
That was a lot, wasn't it? A few pieces.
That's great. I think people can get a lot out of that. All right, well, thanks for coming on the show. This has been awesome, really good conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much. We've enjoyed it.
You know, just going off on a rant on something else.
Oh, no, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
let's go do that barbecue.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, looking forward to it. Thank you.
Special thanks to Sim and Nathan for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. I put up a lot of links for all of the stuff that we talked about, including videos and photos and just other websites, on my own website, which is 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. Thanks once again for listening, and I'll catch you next time.